Well, perhaps we could get it underway, and I want you to know I will not take it personally that given the choice between John Howe and coffee, there are some people that are opting for the latter. But I want to welcome everyone to the Willard and this very special occasion this morning. For many of you, it's special to a certain degree, but it's very familiar, namely the Health Affairs Journal being at the cusp of health policy here in this great city. But what's it make, and that is not unusual, and it's always special, but not unusual. But what makes it special today is that we have a very special introduction. At the outset, let me say that my name is Dr. John Howe, and the president and CEO of Project Hope. Many of you are too young to remember. Maybe one or two of you got a weekly reader and remember the original SS Hope. The brilliant founder, Dr. Walsh, convinced President Eisenhower what was needed was a first ever peacetime hospital ship. But the brilliant Dr. Walsh did one other thing, and that is he created the Health Affairs Journal, which is, as you know, you all participated just a few months ago in its 25th anniversary celebration. So we at Project Hope are very, very proud to be the publisher of this. And it's a point of personal pleasure for me to make the introduction in the first public introduction of our new editor. Last fall, we had a chance to fate John Eichelhart. He is somewhere in the building, roaming around, providing adult supervision for all of us. But we have a new leader, and the new leader is Susan Dentzer. Having said that, on normal times, I would spend 3 minutes extolling her virtues. Because of her stature, that's not needed. As you know, she came from the Lair R. And a distinguished role with that communication vehicle. And before that, U.S. News and Report, before that, Newsweek. And so she brings to the Health Affairs Journal an outreach force and new communication venues that will serve us very, very well. So someone that is very, very familiar to, I welcome Susan Dentzer.
Thank you so much, John, and good morning to all of you. John, I really am grateful to be here as a newly minted member of the Project Hope family. It was, as you said, Bill Walsh's wisdom that led to the foundation of health affairs, and of course, my predecessor, John Eichelhart's not only wisdom, but phenomenal energy. I always refer to him as the James Brown of health policy writing. He was the hardest working and remains the hardest working man in the business. So I'm delighted to be here trying to play backup to James Brown and do the best possible job I can leading health affairs into the future. This is 2008. It's one of those years divisible by four, much like, for example, 1992. And for obvious reasons, chiefly the parallel between those 2 years on many fronts, the apparent rising tide of belief that healthcare reform's time has come again, that it seemed like a good idea for us to take up the topic of this, our third to last issue before the November elections, and thus our issue, Health Reform Revisited. I will note the obvious that in moderating this session today, I'm doing the typical Washington thing, which is coming in well past the 11th hour after everybody else has done all the work, specifically John Eichelhart, Jamie Robinson, my immediate predecessor, and the staff of Health Affairs, many of whom are with us today, all of whom did the hard work to produce this issue. But beyond that, of course, we have the very hard and thoughtful work of the authors. And I want to take a moment now especially to thank our guest editor for the issue, Liz Fowler. Liz, are you here? Well, she'll be here imminently, I'm sure. Liz, as many of you know, is formerly the Vice President for Public Policy and External Affairs at WellPoint, and she's now with the Senate Finance Committee as Senior Counsel. Others who helped us in developing this issue include Lynn Etheridge. If any of you here, please stand up. And I want to thank all the authors in the issue, specifically folks like Gene Sturley of the Urban Institute, Alan Weil of the National Academy of State Health Policy, and so on. Any of you here? Well, I guess they decided to sleep in this morning. I see Alan. He just walked in. There's Alan. And above all, of course, I want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation as the funder of this issue. And I know Adam Coyne from the foundation is here because I saw him. Adam? There he is in the back. Adam, thanks so much for being here on behalf of the foundation. As usual, we really have a terrific smorgasbord in this issue. You don't have to sample everything, but I encourage you to sample many things. And I want to single out some of the especially juicy items in this issue. Gene Sterley and Randy Boberg of Urban Institute have written about budget issues in health reform, and particularly calling attention to what they labeled the original sin in health reform efforts, which is creating entitlements for beneficiaries that are made very specific and then shifting the responsibility for paying for those entitlements to somebody else. A terrific lesson for all of us to take to heart. Kathy Schoen and colleagues from the Commonwealth Fund and Catherine Baker of Harvard have a great article about the interactions between insurance and delivery systems. Bruce Bedakin of Blue Shield of California has a piece about efforts by a broad coalition of insurers to promote universal insurance. Paul Ginsberg from the Center for Studying Health System Change has an article about the evolving role of employers as purchasers. Andy Stern of SEIU writes about the common interests emerging between unions and employers on health reform. And we also have a number of perspectives, memories, bittersweet and sweet, of the Health Security Act by Joe Antos of AEI, Christine Ferguson of George Washington, who, of course, was on the late Senator John Chafee's staff, Len Nichols of the New America Foundation, and Jacob Hacker of Yale. Well, to quote Jamie Robinson's prologue in this issue, in the context of the current election campaign, not surprisingly, we often seem to be back to talking about problem-free and painless health reform. And as Jamie wrote, the mantra today is, think big, but promise no new taxes, no changes for the currently insured, no payment cuts to providers or suppliers, no 500-page policy documents, and nothing that could possibly be lampooned as regulation gone amok. Just change the red side of the Rubik's Cube of health reform, Jamie wrote, without changing the yellow side or the green side or the orange side. Well, we all know that that's not the way things are going to play out, that there will be plenty of changing colors on all different facets of the Rubik's Cube if anything new is to be put together. And assembling a plan in an era when everybody's second best alternative continues to be the status quo is going to be critical. To give us a brief overview of how this Rubik's Cube assemblage will be seen from the perspective of members of Congress, who, as we know, will play a very critical role in assembling it, we're happy to have with us Senator Ron Wyden of Delaware, who also has a
story of my life.
It's amazing how you can see Oregon on the page and read Delaware. This is to err as human. Didn't the Institute of Medicine say that? My apologies. Okay, Ron, well, we'll relocate you back west to Oregon and say that you, together with your colleague on the Republican side of the aisle, Bob Bennett of Utah, have co-sponsored the Healthy Americans Act. And although that is a subject that Senator White is very happy to address, this morning he's going to speak to us about overviews of congressional sentiments as we get ready for what we anticipate may be an era of health reform. So, Senator Wyden.
Thank you.
Of Oregon.
Confirms my theory. I'm barely a household word in my own household. But it's great to be with you, and it seems to me this is something of a kickoff for the next round of the 60-year battle. As you know, we have been working in this country on this since the days of Harry Truman. And in the article that Senator Bennett and I wrote, we argue this time we're going to win. Now, I know that you dedicated readers of health affairs have heard this argument before. Many of you have, it seems to me, dedicated your professional lives to the cause of universal coverage. And at this point, you almost don't want to hope again. You've hoped and hoped in the past, and then you run up against the fierce political and economic realities, and hopes are dashed again. It's almost like that special love affair that just went wrong. So what I want to do for just a minute or two, by way of encouraging you to think that this time it's possible, I want to remind you of all the things that conventional wisdom tells us. Things that people knew were true, couldn't be changed, things you could count on. So here's my list of the things that you knew were true. First, a United States senator could never get off a stage in under 10 minutes. Second, the wild Angela Jolie would never settle down. Third, jail time would devastate Martha Stewart's career. And fourth, a presidential election would hinge on who won my home state of Oregon. So people used to have this kind of faith in the following beliefs about health care reform. One, you'll never get senators of both political parties to agree on health reform. Done. 14 senators now, 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans have joined in the Healthy Americans. Second, you can't pay for universal coverage. Done. The Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Tax folks last week put out a report that said we could get our proposal up and running in 2012. It would be budget neutral in 2014, and we'd start generating surpluses for the federal government in the next year. Third, businesses would never go along. Done. When we kicked off the Healthy Americans Act, Steve Bird, the CEO of Safeway, an NFIB member, a mid-sized manufacturer, all of them stood next to Andy Stern. Fourth, you could never figure out a reason to deal with a dysfunctional insurance market so that private insurers would have an incentive for prevention. Done. We figured out a way to make it attractive for private insurers because they're going to get a chance to stay with their customers over the years to focus on prevention. And finally, you could never make a lighthearted video about the painful subject of job lock. Done. Hope you'll go to careyoukeep.com where you'll see such a thing. But it seems to me, and the only reason I wanted to come today, is this is an important beginning, and a beginning, it seems to me, of a chance where we can really, after 60 years of bickering and partisanship, get this done. I know it's hard to fathom after all the years of past efforts, but I want to wrap it up simply by saying, this time, believe. Thanks. Thank you.
Senator Wyden says he does have a couple moments for questions, so let me just start by asking you, Senator, is your second best alternative to the Healthy Americans Act the status quo? Or do you think there are possibilities for even taking alternative approaches to yours next year?
Susan, my feeling has been that if you had 100 senators co-sponsoring a piece of legislation, you would still just be beginning. The fact of the matter is, a lot of our country thinks that the federal government can't run a 2-car parade, let alone fix American health care. So I'm very much aware of what the odds have been. But I'll tell you, I've gone to see almost 80 senators in their office in the last few months, just to hear them out and to just listen to them. I think this time they want to get it done. So I'm not pretending that any piece of legislation is where we're going to end up. What I'll tell you, though, is that that analysis by the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Tax Committee has told us that if you change the incentives in the system, these incentives that are so skewed and flawed, you can change behavior. And that is really the key to doing this. So we are really just in the beginning of this, Susan, and I don't think any piece of legislation is sort of sent from, you know, Mount Sinai and is now, I see Gene smiling in the front row. I mean, no piece of legislation is written on some tablet and it's now going to become law. But just from the standpoint of bipartisanship and the fact that, unlike 1993, we've got something that says the numbers indicate we can get there, we've got something to work with.
Other questions for Senator Wyden? The news media?
Softball questions are especially welcome at this hour.
I think somebody wants to know what the next video is going to be about.
Well, the next, we're working on the next video. I don't want to kind of give Hollywood away, but it'll involve cake again.
Okay, not pie, cake. Great. Well, Senator Wyden, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're now going to hear from Celinda Lake and Bill McInturff, who also have articles in this issue. Celinda, as we know, is from Public Opinion Strategies. Reverse. Boy, I'm having trouble today. Who the heck wrote these notes, anyhow?
No. When they come from the Democratic side, I'll join them.
Bill McInturff, the co-founder of Public Opinion Strategies, and Celinda Lake, who will talk about their public opinion perspectives. And Celinda has to leave at 9:30, so I think what we'll do is let her present, take questions, and then we'll turn over to Bill.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I want to thank Dr. Howe and the folks at Health Affairs very, very much for their work here. And Susan, I want to really acknowledge there really is I have seen her leadership in several other forums, so it's really exciting to have you here. And I always love presenting with Bill. It's good to present with the pollsters because the data is the data. What you want to do about it afterwards can differ, but usually we agree on at least 90% of what the data says. So let me talk a little bit about what the possibilities are for health care reform, and also acknowledge my colleagues, Bob Crittenden of the Herndon Alliance and David Merman, a partner in our firm, who were co-authors of this article. First of all, it's not accidental that all of the Democratic candidates came out immediately with comprehensive health care reform plans. And you'll hear from two very able spokespeople from two of the major campaigns, the two major campaigns today. And that is because Democrats are part of the core audience for health care reform. But in general, we see health care emerging as a major issue in the electorate. And it's not just an issue, but it's also a value. Voters overwhelmingly believe that health care is a right. And often we think that we will have a conversation with voters that centers on facts and figures, that if we just explain the facts to them, they'll come over to our side. Well, we learned a long time ago that in our business we say if the facts don't fit the frame, then people don't reject the frame, they reject the facts. So facts in our business mean very little, actually. But the fact that healthcare is a value, and it, particularly for women voters, who I will make an audacious prediction, will decide the 2008 presidential election, that's something that really matters. So what are some of the opportunities out there? What are some of the core values the Democrats in particular have to remember to tap into? And frankly, I will say this, that often it's the Republicans who are better at tapping into these values than we are. Value number one is responsibility. People believe that personal responsibility is still very, very important, including in the public arena of health care reform. And they believe that everyone should play a role here, that everyone should take part in that responsibility. And if you don't tap into that value of personal responsibility, you often find that people start to make a distinction between the deserving and the undeserving. Unfortunately, from my perspective and from our side of the aisle, undocumented workers or illegal immigrants being an example of both the wild card in the health care debate and also one of the quote-unquote undeserving. Two ways to tap into this idea of personal responsibility. One is sliding scale, that everyone pays a little. Now, we found out that when we, sometimes on our side, on the progressive side of the aisle, people are worried about charging people anything. We found out that once you invoke that value of personal responsibility, then people said, you know, when we said even $25, people said, well, no, you might be homeless. That might be too much. Let's start at 50 cents. So it's less about the amount of money and more about the value. The second way to invoke personal responsibility is prevention. We found that people overwhelmingly believe that if you engage in preventive behavior, and by the way, people like the word prevention better than wellness. Wellness sounds like, oh, you have to give up those chocolate-filled croissants. Prevention sounds fun. We get to do something fun, like go exercise maybe. But wellness sounds like you got to change your lifestyle. But prevention is, in all seriousness, is part of people thinking that if you engage in these behaviors, then there ought to be reciprocity here. And one of the practices that is bringing people to the table, in short America to the table, and making them most angry is the idea of the fact that you can be excluded still for pre-existing conditions. And people are furious about that insurance practice and understand that insurance practice quite well. A second value that we have to invoke is choice. And you see both of the Democratic presidential candidates leading with the value of choice. It is the number one protector of insured America. We really do live in two Americas. We live in a voting America, which is largely insured, although often feeling underinsured and often feeling like they're paying too much. And we have a non-voting America that tends to be uninsured. If you're uninsured, you don't tend to vote. And in fact, ironically, one of the strongest predictors of not voting is not having health insurance. So choice for insured America, which is voting America, is very, very important, particularly for those women voters who will decide the future of health care reform as well as probably the next president. And that's because they feel that at least if they have the choice of keeping what they have now, that will protect them against declining quality, which is a big concern, and loss of access to their doctor. Peace of mind is a third value, and security is an important value here. And there are two ways in which that value has really been invoked. In this economy, peace of mind and security are a very, very big deal. And even in this economy, as jobs and gas prices kind of overtake healthcare as the number one issue, when both Bill and I wrote our articles originally, healthcare was the number one economic issue. Now it's being pushed down a little bit by rising gas prices. But people are still very, very concerned about peace of mind, concerned about rising costs, concerned about whether their coverage will really cover what they need covered when they have an illness, and concerned about keeping the policy that they have now. Control is also a big issue for women. You know, there was the time when women wanted equality, then we wanted time, then we wanted respect, now we just want control. Control over the healthcare system, a major area in which women voters are focused. And then people want an all-American solution. I want to talk about a great example of where people just reject the facts. We try to tell Americans that they're 37th in the world in health care or 13th in the world. People don't listen to you after you give them that so-called fact. They feel if you're that stupid and idiotic to think that we're really ranked 37th in the world, then really anything else you have to say is not worth listening to. Americans want an American solution. And we found that one of the most powerful values-oriented statements is to say that we have the best health care in the world, but the issue is being able to afford to buy into it and to keep what access to being able to afford access to that best quality health care. So we're going to use American ingenuity to develop the best health care system in the world. We then attacked ourselves, by the way, for being Canadian-style healthcare. People have no idea what Canadian-style healthcare is, but they're absolutely confident they don't want it. Having said that, when we said, okay, you know, we have an American solution here, and then we attacked ourselves for being socialized medicine and Canadian-style healthcare, people stood up in the focus groups and said, no, weren't you listening? This is American-style healthcare. This is not Canadian-style healthcare. What are some of the other issues that anyone grappling with reform has to deal with? The first is the fact that, and I don't think Bill probably has to tell his side of the aisle this very often, but it's constantly something that I have to remind my side of the aisle about, and that is that people come to the healthcare arena not as altruists, not as social workers, but as consumers. And it is a very, very developed frame. And on my side of the aisle, there are a number of people that might wish it were otherwise, but it doesn't take very long for people to ask, what's it going to do to my coverage, and what's it going to cost me? Who's going to pay for it? And it will be forever frustrating, I think, to Democrats that we can have a meeting on with voters on national security and nobody ever asks how much is it going to cost, or we can spend $5,000 a second over in Iraq, but everybody always asks when it comes to health care reform, what's it going to cost? And in addition, the voters are not very confident or able to understand cost shifting. It turns out to be a concept that people are very skeptical of and very concerned about, and they have a very developed frame. And that is that if you bring on 43 million, 47 million, 50 million uninsured, it's going to cost some money. People who haven't had insurance are going to have pent-up health demands. And if you haven't had insurance and you get it all of a sudden, you're going to take those cancer screening tests, you're going to get those tests, that diabetes screening, and there's going to be a certain amount of, at least in the short run, people do believe in the long run you might save money, but in the short run there's going to be a certain amount of money that this is going to cost to bring all these people on board. Women are also worried about scarcity. They worry that they're going to get 10 minutes with their doctor instead of 20 minutes, and that they're going to be 50th in line instead of 25th in line for that appointment. So at least in the short run, there is a real concern for insured America about what it means to bring on uninsured America. And in fact, the more we emphasize uninsured, the more we invoke those concerns with insured, which is voting America. It is very, very important for healthcare reform to be successful to bring something to the table for insured America. And I think in some ways this is the challenge that McCain presents most in terms of his healthcare plan. His healthcare plan actually has a lot of vulnerabilities to it. But I don't think it's accidental, and particularly with Bill advising him, that he starts out with cost and getting costs under control for insured America as his dominant frame. So what are people worried about in terms of cost? Well, one thing they're concerned about is losing all that money that employers put into the system. There used to be a time when people had no idea what their employers were paying for them, but employers have made damn sure that everybody knows what they're paying for them now, particularly as they've increased co-pays, they've delayed raises in wages, arguing that they were paying so much per employee for health care as they've stopped covering dependents and family. And now people are very nervous about losing all of that money. Secondly, people wonder, what's the role for government here? Now, people do not want to go to the government health care clinic. You and I might be fine with going, or some of us in this room may be fine with going to the government health care clinic, but the majority of America is not fine with going to the government health care clinic. They are fine with government playing a role in getting down insurance profits, which is the number one strength that we have on our side, the kind of profits and the kind of increases in rates that have far outstripped wages. People are also fine with government setting basic standards and ensuring a level playing field. But it's important, one of the most important challenges as we come to healthcare reform is to figure out how to define that role for government that will be acceptable to the majority of Americans, and not just to Democrats, but to the independent voters who have renewed interest in healthcare reform, but are not nearly as willing to go for universal coverage as Democrats are, for example. Costs also affect the economy, and one of the things that we're seeing is while people are entering this for their own personal experience and their out-of-pocket costs and their own personal costs, there is an increased linkage to the economy in general. More and more Americans are aware of the impact on healthcare, on our global competitiveness. People can volunteer now all the time. You know, we pay $1,500 a car for health care, we can't compete internationally, and very, very aware as well of the cost of small businesses. Although that's a two-edged sword, obviously, because people are worried about the impact of certain kinds of demands on small business, and people are very, very protective of small businesses. And it's important when we think back to those women who will be so key for reform, 41% of women want to start their own small business. America's in love with small business and very protective of the impact of healthcare reform on small businesses. Well, there are obviously lots of opportunities there for change. Americans overwhelmingly believe the system is not working. How do we animate that change dynamic? Well, the first thing is to realize we used to try on the Democratic side to scare people straight. We'd say, well, you're one paycheck away from disaster. You're one bankruptcy away from, you're one healthcare disease away from bankruptcy. And people could get scared. You can scare people pretty easily. And then they said, you know, you're right. I'm going to hold on to what I have. It does not make people altruistic. We have found that, in fact, what you want to do is animate anger, not fear. When you say to people, do you know in Arizona that pregnancy is considered a pre-existing condition? Do you know that the insurance company's profits have skyrocketed? Ever see a poor insurance company? Ever see any, go to any city in America? Doesn't the insurance company have the highest rising skyscraper in the city? No one ever heard of a poor insurance company. Why does the insurance company spend so much money hiring people just to make sure you get denied coverage as opposed to delivering the coverage you paid for? Animating anger is a way to get insured America, which is voting America, to say, yeah, you know, you're right. And I'm going to do something about that for those people, and I'm going to do something about that for myself. Finally, if we overcome all of those barriers, there is the real politics of Washington, D.C. And one of the challenges we face in healthcare reform is actually the challenge of empowering the public. Because the public feels, even if we could all agree on something, the special interests will steal it away from us. And it's why I think there's a very unique window for the passage of health care reform, and it's in the beginning of the next presidential administration, Democrat or Republican. And I think, actually, it has to be the first thing that we move on. The longer we wait, the less likely we will be to actually be able to build on that momentum of the new presidency and engage the public, overcome the power of what they believe to be entrenched special interests, and empower them for health care reform. So this article, this journal, obviously an important step in setting the agenda and educating us all, and I'd be glad to take questions for a few minutes.
Great. Thank you, Celinda. I'll take the prerogative again of asking you the first one, and then I invite colleagues from the news media and elsewhere to ask questions thereafter. You've laid out so nicely all of the feelings and beliefs that the voters have, but I wonder how they deal with some of the inherent contradictions in their positions. They want choice and stability, but they also want control. They want cost control, but they're worried about cost control leading to scarce resources, 12 minutes with the doctor, et cetera. They don't want a government system, but apparently they don't want the private sector to be able to make any money either, because they don't want particularly well-off insurance companies. So, as we try to sift through this, how do the voters develop some kind of hierarchy about what's most important to them? Because obviously they're not going to get everything that they want.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, of course, the elected officials, Bill and I have something that we always tell our elected officials, which is the voters often hold mutually contradictory views and usually deeply resent having it pointed out to them. So we're not really looking for consistency or logic here. We gave up on that in our professions a long time ago.
Well, it's what Barney Frank always said. People complain about the politicians, but the voters aren't so hot either.
Yeah, there you go. Well, as pollsters, we like the voters, actually. God bless them. And we hope they pick up their phones more often. I think that there are a couple of things. I think, first of all, there is a real desire for change. There isn't much of a desire for status quo, and I don't want to take away, but Bill and Lori discuss in detail in their article that there's also a very dramatic concern about rising costs. Now, that it has a push-pull to it, because on the one hand, Americans are very short of money right now, or feel very short of money, and so that means they are worried about rising taxes as well as rising health care costs. It isn't that people want poor insurance companies, but they do think that the greed of insurance companies as well as oil companies and some of the other actors has really gotten out of range. And they think when insurance costs are going up three times the cost of wages, that something's wrong. So I think what their hierarchy would be is they want to get their costs down, and that is probably the number one contradiction that Democrats at least have to deal with, because their costs include both what they pay for health care and what they pay for taxes, and they are absolutely convinced if you bring on 50 million uninsured, you're going to cost me more. It just has to cost more somewhere. The number one source of money for health care reform, and it's another reason why I think we need to move rapidly on it, is the money that we're spending in Iraq. And I think that's particularly an argument that Democrats can make persuasively. The second thing that people want to do is choice. They want to maintain choice of having what they have now. And I think that's probably some of the things that some of the Democrats understand much less than Republicans do. But obviously, both the major presidential candidates have talked about it a lot, and Gene and David will talk about this, and have guaranteed choice inherently in their plans and set that frame up very fast. And then for women in particular, peace of mind. And women are the healthcare decision makers. It may well be that women decide and influence men in lots of other areas, but healthcare is the one area that they admit it. And so 80% of the decision makers are women, 80% of the healthcare voters are women.
Okay, other questions for Celinda? Yes, Alwyn.
Sure.
And Alwyn, would you do,
Alwyn
please,
Castle with the Center for Studying Health System Change, and I, you know, don't want to be in the position of being an apologist for the insurance industry, but when you talk about animating anger, is there any anger toward the hospitals and physicians and other providers? Because when we talk about costs, I mean, it's fine to point to administrative costs and insurance profits, but at the end of the day, you know, prices go up because of two things, price and increased use and volume of services, and we know that increased use and volume of services and the intensity of services is not non-trivial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have things being pushed and, you know, so I'm just curious, is there a sense that there needs to be animation of anger toward that?
It's a good question. There isn't much anger about doctors. People love their doctors. And they like doctors and nurses are ranked at the top of the healthcare ladder right now. People love their personal doctor. There is some anger at trial lawyers. There is some anger at hospitals. It depends. People are kind of mixed in their views of hospitals. Some anger at drug companies, but also enormous respect for the new drugs. So it's a mixed bag, but I think that, you know, insurance companies are the ones that are the primary focus.
Do what their customers, who are predominantly employers, tell them to do?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, people, I've never asked it that way, and maybe Bill has looked at that. I mean, people think that they're supposed to be the customers. I paid all this money into insurance, and now it won't cover me when I have this, or my copay's up, or my whatever. So people, I don't think, perceive their employers to be customers, if you will. There certainly is some sense that employers have reduced coverage, but there's also some sense that employers have been under enormous cost pressures. And people are very, as mad as people are at business, people are also very nervous about doing anything that would jeopardize any more of our economy or any more jobs. So it's a very complex arena in that regard, I think.
Question here, please. And once again, I'd ask everyone to introduce themselves by name and affiliation.
I'm Bob Rohr, BMJ. Is there any sense within the voters, the public, that there is a significant degree of waste, inefficiency, et cetera, within healthcare, that by squeezing that out, one might be able to afford all of these other great things or not?
Some, but I think people are nervous about being able to get that much out to afford everything else. I mean, certainly people like the idea of, you know, the computerizing the records and things like that. But one person's waste is another person's backup, you know, test that we wanted to get the second opinion on. And one of the roots of the problems is Americans, and it goes to your question as well, Americans have an enormous appetite for consumption of healthcare services. I mean, if we look at the consumer model, and in fact, Americans want to consume more of this service, not less. They want access to the specialist. They want access to the second test, the second opinion, and they want flexibility in that. So I think overshadowing this is the fact that people are wondering, well, what's your idea of waste? Is waste my being able to go to the doctor when I want to, or being able to see the specialist, or is the waste all the paperwork that the insurance companies are making the doctors fill out, or is the waste the malpractice suits that have gotten out of control. So it depends on, people are nervous. Unlike other government programs where people will say, yeah, get all the waste out, we can fund everything with waste, people are a little nervous here about what you call waste.
Celinda, just to close this off,
thank you.
Let me ask you, given your observation that the uninsured don't vote, for example, as well as some of the other observations you made about what the voters do think, if I were a really cynical Democratic presidential candidate, one who did not, for example, believe in the audacity of hope, I might say that I should just shut up completely about the uninsured.
Well, you'd lose the Democratic primary if you did that, because the number one group of people who care about the uninsured are Democratic primary voters. And that's why, one of the many reasons, as well as the audacity of hope and experience in health care.
But mercifully, the long Bataan death march of the primaries appears to be coming to an end.
Well, I'm definitely,
what about in the general?
I get that question. well, in the general, I think, and it's a perfect segue to Bill, I think that McCain has posed a very serious challenge for the Democrats, because he has led, even though I think he has a plan, and I've tested, in fact, that has a lot of weaknesses in the public's mind, and Democrats have 30 and 40 points more credibility on health care, I think he has been very audacious and very smart in leading aggressively with cost, and it's a challenge to the Democratic nominee.
And with that,
thank you,
Celinda Lake. And now we'll hear from the other side, Bill McInturk.
Hi. Well, Susan has moderated other panels that I've done, and so she called me with this story. So I want you to remember the story of my favorite professor in college. He's a professor of philosophy, and he used to like to talk about the Philosophy 101 student. And the question in the essay was, who was Socrates? And the freshman student wrote, Socrates was a great philosopher. Socrates talked and talked and talked. Socrates was killed. And she said, Bill, I've seen you before. I'd like you to please keep this in mind, given our time constraints today. But that's really a nice, helpful way as me, well, to also thank my co-author, Laurie Weigel, my partner. I talk for a living. I'm scheduled in half-hour increments, given my attention span issues. Laurie has a big capacity for sustained focus on one topic, and she's a very good writer, and I'm blessed to have her help me with this article. In 1991, I did a speech with Judy for the National Health Policy Forum talking about why insurers would get whacked, why we would have health care as a center of the 92 debate, and why I really felt the Democrats were overreaching and they would implode eventually because they'd gone far beyond public opinion. And then in 93, 94, I did the work that became Harry and Louise. I did the work for the RNC and all the other folks who opposed the plan. So now I've been doing this long enough that I share the same skepticism that Senator Wyden referred today in healthcare, which was, we've been doing this a long time. But the point of my health affairs article was to do exactly that. And I was asked to kind of contrast that earlier time period with today. And I do come to the same conclusion, which is we do have one of those unique windows of opportunity to have significant change in healthcare. What is required to have that happen? Number one, what has to happen is healthcare is inexorably linked with the economy. And when the economy, we have a job-based economic system, we have an employer-based healthcare system, and when people get very anxious and concerned about the economy, they get very anxious and concerned about the stability of their own coverage. And so, number one requirement for significant healthcare reform is a very soft economy. And in that regard, there's nothing, I mean, this is as bad or worse than 1992 in terms of people's attitudes about the economy. And economic attitudes in this country have collapsed, and we are running in one of the worst public confidence economies in post-World War II history. And by the way, no incumbent party has ever held the White House when economic confidence is low, which again gives a sense of perspective for Senator McCain. Now, in that regard, we have to, though, understand something else, that when we ask people, what do you, and we gave people a list of all these different items, say, what are you concerned about? When you talk about being concerned about the economy, what are you concerned about? 55% the cost of gasoline, the cost of everyday price goods and services, number three, 29% the cost of health care. That, again, health care is embedded in what people mean by when they talk about the economy. Now, in your press packages, we just did this very nice survey for Robert Wood Johnson. It's an incredibly interesting survey with lots of cool data. But one of those things was we gave people a list of 10 or 12 items and said, which one of these things would do the most to help the average American deal with today's economic situation? The number one item was make healthcare more affordable. And by the way, as Linda said, it's very clear what that attribute means is make me pay less out of pocket and make other people pay less out of pocket for health care. And I think she's indeed right in terms of Senator McCain's focus, talking about what could be done so that you pay less and that we all pay less for health care. Now, the second thing that has to happen is people to be fed up with the current status quo. We've been doing this very, it's not even actually a question I like very much, we just have done it for a long time. And that question is, in terms of the healthcare system, do you want radical change, some change, or do you want to keep things pretty much the way they are? In January of 92, about 45% said radical change. Mark Mellman, my another Democrat counterpart, used to say at the time, you know, in the American political lexicon, radical is not a good word. And to have almost a majority of people in the country saying they want radical change is a big deal. Now, I've tracked that question since 92, and we're up to 36%. That's a big number, because every time we've gotten to mid-30s or higher, we've had a huge debate about health care. In 92, it happened in 98 when we were meltdown about HMOs, and we're having it today. Now, here's an important difference. Among the highest people who say they want radical change are small business owners, 43%, and people who work in small business, people who work in companies of less than 10 employees, 48%. Now, I'm not saying that the small business community is going to sign up to, you know, for a single payer system. I'm just saying that the kind of 93 NFIB battle to the death over the Clinton plan, I think the business community, and especially the small business community, has been roiled enough that they are not reflexively in the same position in terms of their in terms of presuming that a Democrat plan is a bad idea. They want significant change. Now, the other things that are like 92, I do polling for NBC Wall Street Journal. Hart wrote this very interesting question, kind of, do you want government to do more or less? The first track of that was in 95, after the beginning of Speaker Gingrich's era. Almost two-thirds of Americans said they want government to do less. Today, over this decade, and over 12 or 13 years, we watch this gradual shift. So today, a comfortable majority, low 50s, 55%, say, no, I want government to do more. And that's an underlying shift in terms of attitudes about government that set the predicate for why there could be healthcare change. Now, what is something that is, to me, really different? And that is, of course, the role of Iraq. I believe that Iraq has fundamentally changed American politics in this regard. The extraordinary cost of what we spent in Iraq has led to a public anger that is money that we are spending to try to rebuild another country instead of this country, and it's provided this plausible dialogue, which is a Democrat candidate for president can say plausibly, if we can spend $150 billion to $200 billion a year in Iraq, we can spend X, fill in the blank, $80 billion, $100, $110 billion a year to provide health care for more Americans. I don't think Senator Kerry could have said that in 2004. In fact, he didn't. That kind of price tag was not plausible in 2004. I think Iraq has shifted the dialogue about the price tag. What else do I think is of importance as we kind of compare these eras and we kind of learn from history? Now, when people ask and say, and I say, why, Bill, are you Republican? What I say is I believe in the power of market forces. I believe in the power of markets. And what I say good humoredly is Senator Clinton is my best example in the power of markets. If you read her health plan, it's called the American Health Choices Plan. The first line of her press release was, if you are satisfied and happy with the care you receive and the providers and the insurance coverage you have, you can keep it. No one will ever change it. That's the power of market, because her plan in 93 and 94 would have shifted a lot of people very satisfied with their own coverage. And what it reflects is that, again, what people have an extraordinary cautious about is they feel themselves lucky to have good private coverage, and they don't want it altered. And in that regard, by the way, and of course, it's always Senator Wyden is always engaging, and he's always a committed advocate. But you know, if you look at his plan calls for defunding the employer-based system, compelling employers to give the money instead to employees. And, you know, and this is, of course, the same challenge Senator McCain has with his tax credits, which Doug can talk about, is people say what you will for all the grumbling. If you give them a choice, 6 out of 10 say, no, I like the employer system. Please don't change it. Let's build around it. And so in some interesting ways, we're going to kind of see that debate. I think the last cautions are the trade-offs. And what I'm saying is there, to me, are fundamental trade-offs that have not shifted about the American electorate. The first and most fundamental is a trade-off that says, I will get a little bit less so that everyone in America gets a little bit more. No. And that's, I think, something Celinda said pretty powerfully, but I thought we just want to reinforce it. When healthcare reform gets to that dialogue, it collapses. Number two, people are quite hesitant to pay more of their own funds to change the healthcare system. I think if you look at the public data, when the Democrats say we should, in fact, reverse the Bush taxes and on people who make more than $200,000 or $250,000, majorities, comfortable majorities say, that's fine, I'd do that. The trouble is that if you probe a little further, Salinas again said this, but just not quite so bluntly, is that what you say to people say, well, yeah, that's where they'd start, but you couldn't possibly cover 50 million people with just that money. You would have to come from me. And I think there's still a good deal of reluctance about that. And then I think the number three area is, again, people get very concerned about, are you going to disrupt kind of a system that for them, for again, 8 out of 10 Americans, they say works pretty well for them and their families. And so they are, I think, very amenable. And I do want to speak as well in terms of some other stuff in this Robert Wood Johnson data. We have the highest number ever in a decade saying they think the uninsured will increase in the next decade, and the highest number ever saying they're hearing a discussion about making sure we have coverage for families and children. Because this presidential debate is like we're going to have a huge debate about health care, and I'm so glad you have people here from the campaigns. Because we haven't had one yet, because it's not an issue Republican primary voters care about. The Democrats have been pretty consistent. The two of them are pretty similar. Now that we get rid of, you know, we have one final nominee from each party, the differences are pretty profound. And we will do what we do pretty well in this country. We just have a huge national debate. And I think after Iraq and after the, and I think health care will become a huge debate because there's a huge difference between candidates. That's what campaigns are about. And my last note, and I do agree with Celinda, is that in 2009, if there is going to be change, it's got to be done relatively quickly. And if, this is a big ish, if there were a Democrat president, he or she would serve with expanded Democrat majorities. I have been in that happy situation where Republicans get a little happy with themselves. The partisans of both parties tend to overreact and tend to go for the gusto in terms of the best, you know, like what they've always really secretly wanted. It's very hard to constrain your partisan enthusiasms. But what we're talking about here is the real challenge, if there were a Democrat president and expanded Democrat majorities, is how you could restrain those enthusiasms to get to actually a bill that you could get through the American public and actually build a consensus support. In some ways, I think they are and will be advantaged from the overreach of 93. But unfortunately, history lessons say pretty quickly that's a long time ago in dog years. Politics is in dog years. In dog years, it's a long time ago. If it is President McCain, I think President McCain will be serving with Democrat majorities. Sorry to say that in public, but that's what I think. And in some ways, then this is kind of what America likes. They're not worried about that. They don't think that's a bad outcome because they believe it compels compromise around the middle. What I do think that is true is that that the American electorate has dragged our nominee and the Republican Party to have a debate about health care far bigger in scope than we've had probably a Republican have to have in a long time. And I think it's a consequence. You know, this is the advantage of town hall meetings. You can't do 150 town hall meetings and not talk about health insurance reform, guaranteed issue, community rating, and stuff that you hear about all the time in 150 town meetings. And so I believe that should John McCain become president, which is my hope, that he would still be committed to significant change in health care in a way that's very different from the last generation. And I think in that way, Susan, that we're also looking at a prospect for why I do think there's a prospect for either party that we could have much bigger health care change in 2009 than we might be imagining here today. So with that as an overview, we look forward to comparing your notes and questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. So politics is measured in dog years, and now we have a couple of dog minutes for questions here. Let's talk specifically about what you said about how 6 out of 10 people like the employer-based system, and obviously the majority of Americans who have private coverage have it through employers. What vulnerabilities does that create for Senator McCain, given his proposal to take the tax exclusion for health insurance and recycle that into tax credits, refundable tax credits, that could, fear is very strong that that could jeopardize the employer-based system, particularly for small businesses?
Number one, it makes it very incumbent that people understand that, and this is very powerful, that they will have coverage they can keep, that the dialogue, and you could certainly mention it, that the dialogue that you could have with people about you would pick your coverage and you could keep your coverage as you move from job to job and you can move from job to home, that attribute is very, very powerful. And number two, you have to explain this, which is people believe after 3 generations there's 2 rates, the group rate for major employers who get good deals and an individual rate where you're left on your own. And they need to understand, and this is part of the dialogue, they need to understand that No, we're talking about millions and millions of people who can select their own coverage, and those pools would lead to competitive rates. And so John's, and Doug, of course, can speak more powerfully about this than I can, but John's proposal also has buying across state lines. It has the association/small business health plan. It's got other things that would create a marketplace that would keep people into affordable coverage. And so people have to understand that these are linked concepts. The notion that you would be able to select and get your own coverage is linked with a very different type of insurance market than they have now. And that's actually, and that's what Celinda was saying again in her charitable and polite way as always, which is that's a lot of things to communicate about a proposal in a campaign. That's what I'm saying. That's not God bless running for president and not U.S. Senate. Because when you run for president, there's 60 to 90 million people who watch debates, and they watch and learn in a way that we never get in any other kind of public dialogue. But and then the third thing, of course, is, and this is what Celinda has also said, is that John's plan talks an enormous amount about what you will do to constrain cost and what it means for your cost as well and why the Democrats have taken a pass on that and what that difference is. And those are 2 or 3 things that are that make this a plausible public debate. But, you know, I do this for a living, and as I'm saying, when you've got to do that much education, you do, in fact, have a really substantial communication challenge. And I'm just happy that it's for president, not U.S. Senate, that there's a mechanism in place to have that kind of education you don't get through any other office.
Great. Other questions for Bill McInturff?
Mark McCarty with Medical Device Daily. It seems rather obvious to state that a specific issue will play a little bit differently in a general election than it does in a primary, and so this probably may hold true for the war in Iraq, which may come off as more of a national security issue in a general election than it does in the Democratic Party primary. Is there a danger to trying to play the war in Iraq off as a waste of money in a general election?
Well, that's... I don't want to stray too far from our topic, yes.
Thank you for that probing and thoughtful answer, Bill. Let's take a question back here.
Deborah Cohn with the American Medical Association. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Deborah.
I'm curious as to whether your survey or any of the surveys that have been done recently about healthcare have looked at the question of whether Americans are aware of the upcoming shortages in physicians to care for people and physicians and other healthcare workers, especially as the boomers start to age, because that's a real issue that in these surveys, I don't really see addressed.
We have done this. We've actually done this more in congressional studies, interviewing congressional staffers. But we've touched on this issue. I think people are, frankly, more aware of not so much of physicians, but on nursing and other shortages. in a hospital setting, they can see and have talked about those differences. They have talked about the disincentives they can see for why, who would want to be a physician. They don't make the money they used to. They have this kind of impact with insurers. They get sued all the time. The OBGYN issue in terms of coverage and physicians dropping or moving from states is, in some states that have had physician migration, this is a big issue, like West Virginia, Nevada, and others. So we've had some states where this has been a real issue. But I've got to say, on the hierarchy of what people are concerned about on a day-to-day basis, these are awareness issues, but they are, I think, Deborah, could still be characterized as being pretty far below the bundle of stuff that we're talking about here.
Great. Let's take one more question over here.
John Oglehart from Health Affairs. Bill, I have a hard time thinking of cost control or cost containment as a winning political issue over the years. I think of Part D, for instance, as a $1 trillion unfunded mandate or benefit. And my question is, how challenging will it be for Senator McCain in the general election to make arguments about cost control or cost containment a winner for him politically?
Well, of course, you know, John is a pretty iconoclastic Republican. He voted against Medicare Part D for exactly that reason. He also supports importation of drugs from Canada. He's much harsher on the health insurance industry than the characteristic Republican, including his health care speech, which has got, so the typical things you expect from a Republican candidate that would make it difficult, John's kind of iconoclastic range of views means he can talk about reducing care, the cost of care, in unusual ways for Republicans. Because it's the unusual Republican who'd say, yeah, we should make drugs less expensive, let's import them from Canada. Yes, I have no trouble whacking insurance companies as part of the solution. That's not what typically Republicans have done. They've been too often ended up defending the private insurance industry, which, by the way, is my major client, and and they will tell you very exactly they don't have anywhere near the margins these big bills are paid for because of the other parts of their insurance business, not health. But the other thing that, and we've heard those questions to Celinda, is that people do believe that, physicians and others are spending a fortune because of the way they practice medicine because of the legal environment. Let's go back to the John Kerry, George Bush campaign in 2004. Second debate, Bush says we're spending like 5 or 6% or something of all healthcare costs is wasteful medicine because of legal stuff. John Kerry does his John Kerry thing and says in the third debate, Mr. President, you're just simply wrong. Medical malpractice costs are only like they're only like 0.08%. And then Bush says, we do dials to swing them to voters. And Bush says, no, I'm not talking about the out-of-pocket for the medical cost, for the liability. I'm talking about what it means. What it means for extra tests, what it means for this, what it means for this. And every time he's talking about what it means for the wasted money in healthcare, the lines are going up and up and up. And Bush is saying it's because your party won't restrain the trial bar, and we will. And it worked really powerfully. And having watched that line as Bush was trying to rebut, it was one of the single most powerful things he did in the third debate. That was the single most effective thing with Senator Kerry. Now, for example, I've done focus groups with primary care physicians, like in Illinois and other parts, and they say, so let me get this right. We're going to extend care to all these kids, we're going to extend care, and I'm going to get it at Medicaid rates, which in my state means they run out of money in July and I don't get paid, and I have the same legal exposure. Could you at least, Bill, go back and tell Congress, if I'm going to have to extend care, to make sure there's a rational system and process when I treat these people, that sure, I should be medically reviewed. I should be medically reviewed by my peers. And if I screwed up, I should be sued. But something that creates a boundary in terms of lawsuits. And so, for example, I love that. And I love the idea that if we're going to extend coverage, let's protect the physicians. Why do I like it? I like it because I don't think a single Democrat nominee could say yes because of the trial bar. And so I hope that under what we mean by controlling cost, that you can bundle those iconoclastic views of Senator McCain's with some of what I just said and a few other things to make this a pro-consumer and give them a plausible other answer for the kind of shared, you know, guilt or blame. And I'm saying McCain can do it across provider groups in a way most Republicans can't that could be, I hope, fairly compelling.
Well, Bill, we want to make sure that, unlike Socrates, you get out of here alive. So thank you very much for a terrific overview. Okay, we've heard about the... Thanks so much, Bill. We've heard about the big political enchilada, which is what the voters think, rational or not. Now we're going to talk about the big substantive enchilada, which is the budget, the federal costs, and the role of taxation. And I'm delighted now to bring up onto the dais Jason Furman, a senior fellow of the Brookings Institution, and Peter Orszag, director of the Congressional Budget Office. Jason has a terrific article, as you'll see, and you'll hear about momentarily, about the menu of options of tax proposals to help finance health reform and what is standing in the way, intellectually or politically, of having these proposals come to fruition. And then we'll hear about from Peter about some scoring issues and other things that will be determinative in the possible health reform debate to come.
Well, thank you very much to Health Affairs for organizing this terrific issue, which I really look forward to reading. I've learned a lot over the last hour and look forward to hearing from the campaigns after this. There's a lot of very important issues in healthcare, probably every single one of them covered in this issue of Health Affairs, and my article really focuses on just one of them. And I'm not trying to make the case that it's the single most important or that it's the one thing you need to know about, but it is one very important issue, and it's the intersection between health care and taxes. And I'd say it's one very important issue because it affects three of the major goals of health reform. The first is how many people are insured is very much determined by the way in which we give out subsidies for health insurance, which we give out in a certain form today. The second is how much insurance costs depends a lot on how you divide up insurance between what's paid in advance and what's paid out of pocket and what sort of insurance plans people buy in terms of what's covered, what's not, what types of hoops do they need to go through to spend money. And finally, it has a big impact on a third issue, which is how much the federal government spends on health care. The federal government spends money directly, obviously, through Medicare and Medicaid, and then it spends money indirectly through a set of subsidies, which economists would describe as a tax expenditure. And in fact, the federal tax expenditure for health care is about $200 billion a year. There's different ways to measure it, depending on what you include, which is about the same as federal spending on Medicaid. Unlike Medicaid, this $200 billion then leverages up another about $800 billion of spending on private insurance and has an effect on how all $800 billion of that is spent. I think this pervasiveness of taxes in the health system is why tax policy is a central part, or a very important part, of virtually all the proposals that you see for health reform. It's an important part of the Wyden-Bennett plan that Senator Wyden talked a little bit about this morning. It's a very important part of John McCain's plan, who proposes, and I don't think he describes it this way, but one could think of it as, in effect, a $3.6 trillion tax increase over the next decade by making employer contributions to health insurance taxable. And then you take all $3.6 trillion of that and use it to finance refundable tax credits. It's also an important part of the Obama and Clinton health plans. And they haven't broken down their plans in terms of taxes and outlays and all that. So just in terms of approximate numbers, you could think of those plans as, in effect, raising about $500 billion over the next decade in taxes, in their case outside the health system, by raising taxes on high-income households, and then putting that money into the health system for tax credits for coverage. It may be more or less than $500 billion. I don't know the breakout. Maybe we'll hear it on the next panel. So in a sense, you'd have the $3.6 trillion in subsidies that you have today, and you'd add a new $500 billion. So you'd have about $4.1 trillion of tax subsidies for health care in the system. And taxes are an important part of a range of other proposals. And I think, in part, this is because the tax code is already central to health care. I think, in part, it's because you want to have a plan that relies on a familiar, tried, and tested infrastructure of the IRS and the tax system, especially if your plan is income-related, because the IRS collects data on everyone's income and has it in a very easy form. And then finally, we shouldn't kid ourselves, but everyone from both parties would much rather talk about tax cuts than spending increases. So to the degree you can describe your plan as a tax cut rather than having an equivalent plan described as a spending increase, that continues to hold a certain amount of political appeal. So for all these reasons, I think taxes are important today and taxes are important to reform. In the remainder of my comments, I'm going to first provide a brief description of how the tax code today affects health insurance today, and then I'm going to provide you with a brief typology and analysis of some of the different reform options, including, again, some of the ones in the presidential campaigns, as well as some of the others floating around. So first, when I keep talking about the tax treatment of healthcare, the most important is that if you are an employer and you provide insurance to your employees, the amount you pay for their insurance is not taxed. So if you pay someone in wages, that's taxed. If you pay someone in fringe benefits, most of those are taxed. This particular fringe benefit is not taxed. And so it's a way of paying people money, a way of people, in effect, earning income or compensation without paying taxes on it. And that is a tax subsidy. There's some other ones, but they pale in magnitude. The cost of it in terms of income taxes and then the pure tax portion of payroll taxes is about $200 billion annually at the federal level, and then there's an additional cost at the state level. And this tax treatment has a number of effects. Some of them I think most of us would agree are good. Some of them I think most of us would agree are bad, and some of which a lot of us would disagree with many of the others of us. So to go through some of those, the first is that you probably get more coverage overall. When you subsidize something like purchasing insurance, you're going to get more people to purchase insurance. And I think that's probably in the good category for most people. The second is you have more of an incentive for high-income households to purchase insurance than for low-income households to purchase insurance. And the reason is that a deduction has a value that is equal to the amount you deduct, so that's the amount your employer pays for your insurance. And a high-income household is more likely to get insurance from their employer and more likely to have a generous plan that their employer is paying more of, so that base is more generous. And it's then valued at the marginal tax rate, the rate at which you pay taxes. Both of those combine to mean that a typical low-income family might get something like an 8% subsidy on their insurance. 8% of it is paid for by the government in the form of lower taxes, and they have to pay 92%. A high-income family gets a 32% subsidy, a subsidy that's four times as large. I think most of us could probably put that upside-down system where you get the largest incentives to purchase insurance if you have the highest income in the bad category. The two that are more debated are that you get more coverage through employers rather than through the individual market. Some people think that's a great thing. Some people think it's a problem that they want to solve. And that the tax incentive for insurance both subsidizes a product, so it leads you to buy more of it and drives up the price of it, and it also creates a non-level playing field where you get subsidized on your premium that you pay at the beginning of the year, but not on out-of-pocket expenses that you pay throughout the year. So that encourages you to buy plans with higher premiums and lower out-of-pocket spending, which in turn encourages people to spend more and drives up the cost of health insurance. The mixture of what's good and bad in the existing tax exclusion is what makes the area so important and complex. The fact that there are these bad effects of the tax exclusion means there's potentially a really big benefit to reforming it. The fact that there are good effects of the tax exclusion mean that you need to be really careful when you reform it, because you don't want to lose those good ones when you're fixing the bad ones. And all of this is made even more complicated by the fact that on some of these, especially related to the individual market, we can't even agree whether that's in the good category or the bad category. So with that background about the existing system in mind, I'll now talk about what some of the different proposals out there propose to do about it. And in my article, I propose a typology where I categorize the dozens of different proposals that you could possibly have based on how they answer two questions. First question is the main goal of the reform to lower spending, for example, HSAs, or is the main goal to expand coverage, like the tax part of the Clinton and Obama proposals? There's a lot of other things in those proposals related to cost that I'm not talking about. The tax part itself, the tax subsidies, are designed to encourage coverage expansions. The second question to divide these plans is, what's the means by which they achieve that goal in terms of lower spending and expanded coverage? And I divide that into ones that add new tax breaks on top of the existing ones. So that's like HSAs or Obama-Clinton basically add new tax breaks to the existing $3.6 trillion over the next decade, or the ones that reform the existing tax breaks, which is the president's proposal or John McCain's proposal. So with that twofold set of questions, I'll now go through a whirlwind tour of some of those proposals out there. The first is new tax incentives to cut spending, and this is things like HSAs, the president's proposal 2 years ago to expand HSAs, making out-of-pocket expenses tax deductible. And this is one of the areas where I have the fewest nice things to say about it. It's also one of the areas that doesn't have any defender on the next podium, since Mitt Romney was the only presidential candidate that proposed something that would fall into this category. And going beyond some of the issues on HSAs about, you know, risk and expenses and government-designed health plans and all of that, the fundamental issue with all of this is the philosophy is, you have all these tax breaks encouraging you to spend more, and here's my solution. Just add one more tax break to all the ones we already have, and now everyone's going to magically spend less. When you do the arithmetic on that, it occasionally can work. Sometimes two wrongs do make a right. In a lot of these plans, it's very uncertain, and it could end up that by adding new tax incentives to encourage people to spend more, less money, you're actually giving more tax advantage to health spending overall and could end up increasing health spending. So I think this is a particularly fraught area to go down, where you're basically certain that you have a budgetary cost, and you're very uncertain if it has a benefit. It could even backfire. The second area is new tax incentives to expand coverage. And I divide this into two groups. The first is purely subsidizing people for the individual market without doing anything else. So, for example, making individual market premiums tax deductible. The benefit of that is people in the individual market now have more tax advantages to buy insurance. The disadvantages of that are that if they are low income, which disproportionately the uninsured are, those new tax benefits don't do anything for them. If they don't have an affordable plan because they have a pre-existing condition, which a lot of the uninsured also have, this doesn't provide any means for them to get insurance. And if they previously were covered by a small business whose manager, for instance, decides that he or she now wants to take advantage of this new tax break and doesn't want their employers to have coverage, you can end up losing your coverage through an employer. So this is a little bit of the structure of what I just described, where you have a certain budgetary cost of this tax incentive for the individual market, and you have very uncertain benefits. I think if you design plans in the genre well, you can get very small coverage benefits, maybe $1 or $2 million. Some of them, John Gruber in the past has estimated that you can actually spend money and increase the number of uninsured because you get more people dropped by their employers becoming uninsured than you get people who are uninsured suddenly being able to afford coverage because of this. So this, again, is an area, a route to reform where there's a lot of certainty that you're going to spend money and a lot of uncertainty about what the benefits are. Within that same category of trying to expand coverage through new tax breaks, you have proposals that embed those tax breaks in a much broader set of reforms that typically have something like a new pool, like the FEHBP or the Connector Plan, and some other mechanism to help people get coverage, either an individual mandate, an employer pay or play, automatic enrollment, some institutional mechanisms like that. These can help to mitigate some of the dropping problems, to mitigate some of the problems of people entering insurance who are uninsured today, and if the subsidies are income-related, solve the problem of low-income households not getting any benefit from the tax deduction. As a result, these are the types of plans that you can be reasonably confident that they'd be successful in their goal of expanding the coverage and potentially even getting universal coverage, because there's a lot of mutually reinforcing mechanisms. The only downside is the cost, and John Gruber estimates that it costs about $124 billion to cover everyone through tax subsidies. And then you're faced with a trade-off. Is it worth that $124 billion a year that you want to raise from somewhere else in order to expand coverage? My personal view is it very much is. But you have to acknowledge that trade-off and weigh those two against each other. Which brings us to the last one, and I will go 1 or 2 minutes over, which is to replace the existing tax incentives with a new set of tax incentives. So as I said, for instance, raise taxes by $3.6 trillion by making everyone pay taxes on their employer-sponsored health insurance, and then reallocate that $3.6 trillion in a different way that you think is more likely to expand coverage and more likely to expand it in the ways that you want. So the McCain plan would reallocate it so that if you would get a $2,500 tax credit if you were purchasing individual coverage, and a $5,000 refundable tax credit if you were purchasing family coverage. The logic of this is that you have much more of an incentive to go from no insurance to some insurance. If you could find a $5,000 insurance plan, I don't know that anyone can, but if you could find one, you'd even have 100% of the cost of it covered. See, all of your limited tax dollars, more of them are going to go from nothing to something. And that's where the evidence that the biggest gains from insurance in terms of health are. You then get no subsidy at the margin to go from some insurance to more insurance. And the hope is that the evidence there is that there are fewer gains to be had on that margin. It's ecumenical about how you reduce your health spending, because you could do it through an HMO or you could do it through an HSA or you could do it with any way you want. It's not like the government has picked out a health plan. And it can solve some of the upside-down incentives. Those are some of the advantages of it. The big disadvantage is all of the problems I talked about with the individual market before are still there in terms of leveling the playing field, putting people into this uncertain market, and if you don't have a pooling mechanism, if you don't have a mandate, automatic enrollment, pay or play, or one of those types of mechanisms, you, again, are making a trade-off this time between the potential benefits of a reform that pays for itself and doesn't increase the deficit, but a downside of much more uncertainty about what the effects on employer-sponsored insurance, what the effects on the individual market, than what you would see in a plan that's willing to, in effect, put new dollars into the system to buy down that uncertainty. In conclusion, my survey of this leads me to think that you definitely don't want to do things that have certain costs and uncertain benefits, like new tax incentives to spend less money or tax-deductible insurance in the individual market. Second, everything else has trade-offs. So you might have a trade-off between a budgetary cost and certainty. So you can pay money to be much more certain your plan is going to work, or you can not put new money in and be less certain about how it's going to work. And finally, the biggest payoff is trying to reduce that uncertainty through methods outside the tax system, these types of pooling, enrollment, behavioral, and other mechanisms. And we shouldn't use this one instrument to accomplish everything we want to accomplish. We have a lot of other instruments we can use to also make health reform work. And Peter will probably talk about the rest of them.
Great. Thank you, Jason. And we'll turn directly to Peter Orszag.
Thank you very much. I will try to be a bit brief, and maybe I'll even make up for Jason's 1 or 2 minute overrun. And I'm just going to make 4 basic points, the first of which anyone who has heard me speak on this topic over the last year and a half will have already heard, but just to start there, it is clear to me, and I think it's clear to anyone who's actually looked at the numbers, that the rate at which healthcare costs grow is the key to our fiscal future. And I think, again, just to underscore the point, we have largely misdiagnosed the nation's long-term fiscal problem by overestimating or over-exaggerating the role of demographics and underemphasizing the role of increasing costs for beneficiary. Most of the projected growth in Medicare and Medicaid costs does not come from the fact that there will be more beneficiaries and they will be older beneficiaries in the future. Most of the projected growth in Medicare and Medicaid comes from higher costs per beneficiary in the future. And until we get that basic fact in our head, we are going to be misallocating our analytical resources in terms of trying to tackle the underlying problem. There has been some continuing debate among some analysts with regard to the underlying analytics on that point. CBO will be coming out with an issue brief showing that regardless of how you do the calculation, you can do it this, that, and the other way, the majority of the cost growth comes from higher cost per beneficiary. Embedded in that fact, though, I do think is a very substantial opportunity, which, again, I have spoken of before, which involves the opportunity to reduce healthcare costs without impairing health outcomes. I think this is perhaps the single biggest opportunity we have to improve economic efficiency in the United States. I formed a panel of health advisors at CBO and asked them what share of healthcare services delivered in the United States did they believe did not improve health outcomes regardless of the political economy difficulty of addressing the issue. And the answers range from 5% to 50%, with the modal answer being 30%. 30% of 16% of GDP is 5% of GDP, and healthcare services delivered. This is not profits or, you know, other things that people talk about. This is actual MRIs and surgeries and hospitalizations that do not improve health outcomes. 30% of 16% of GDP is 5% of GDP, or $700 billion a year. As an economist who has sort of played in many different worlds in policy settings, there is not another area, regardless of whether you're talking about marginal tax rates or impediments to international trade or what have you, all the things that economists tend to spend most of their time on, that comes remotely close to 5% of GDP. So there is a very substantial opportunity here. But what about capturing it? I heard a little bit of discussion about the political economy of reform. Let me put forward, before getting to some of the pathways to trying to bend that curve, a hypothesis that most of the motivation for addressing our long-term fiscal problems has been framed exactly as that, that we need to address the problem now so that our kids and grandkids and their kids and grandkids are better off. And from what I can observe, that doesn't seem to be generating much action. It strikes me that our political system simply does not deal well with gradual long-term problems. And the fact of the matter is, this is a gradual long-term problem. But it also has things that are happening today that it may be more immediately salient. And it strikes me that trying to capture those immediately salient and immediately implementable things, or immediate things that would have immediacy, may be better from a political economy perspective, while also having the great benefit, from my perspective, of helping to address the nation's long-term fiscal problem. So, for example, if you look in the last 6 months of life at UCA Medical, Medicare beneficiaries last 6 months of life, average cost at UCA Medical is $50,000 a year. At the Mayo Clinic, it's $26,000 a year. All of you, and there's no quality difference, if anything, the imperfect quality indicators that we have suggest the Mayo Clinic does better. All of you in this room who are American taxpayers are paying for that difference today, and you have absolutely no idea what you're getting in exchange for it. And that's not about your kids or grandkids, that's about your tax dollars today. Perhaps more important, and this is something that I think has not received enough attention, I think a key factor that perpetuates inefficiency in the health system is that most of us don't realize how much our employer-sponsored insurance is costing us. We focus on out-of-pocket expenses and sort of direct costs, but all of the evidence and all of the economic theory suggests that ultimately we all pay in the form of reduced take-home pay for the employer-sponsored insurance, the part that the employer, quote, pays, and yet we don't sort of focus on that, and that leads to less demand for efficiency in the health system today than would otherwise be the case. I was speaking at a Brookings conference on a similar topic, and I was amused that two leading health economists discussed this question. The first one said that he had spent about a half an hour on the Harvard intranet trying to find out how much Harvard contributed for his health plan, could not find the information that he thought was relevant, and then realized he wasn't covered by Harvard's plan because he was on his spouse's plan. The second illustrious, and these are actually quite serious people, the second Harvard economist then said, don't you realize that Harvard's been providing that information on paper pay stubs in a sort of box for some period of time? At which point, a Harvard law professor who is also cognizant and knowledgeable about economic matters came up and said, don't you realize that Harvard discontinued paper pay stubs several years ago? At the end of this discussion, which consumed the entire break during the Brookings conference, I was still confused about what information Harvard did or did not provide, let alone, and more importantly, how much the contribution actually was. And I think there's an important point there. The backlash that we hear about out-of-pocket spending, which is significant, is striking when you realize that out-of-pocket spending is only 15% of the total. If workers realized how much they were actually giving up today, your take-home pay today is being reduced by $10,000 for a family plan or whatever the number is, and that number could be significantly lower if we could capture these efficiencies, it strikes me that that would lead to much more demand and much more political economy push for capturing this potential opportunity than arguments that may strike some as abstract about our long-term future. Okay, so what about what are the pathways to actually capturing these potential opportunities? I think there are three things that are key regardless of the structure with which you pursue them. We need far more information about what works and what doesn't in our healthcare system because too much of the healthcare delivered in the United States is not backed by specific evidence that it works any better than anything else. We need to change our financial incentives so that we have incentives for better care rather than more care. And we have to pay way more attention to psychology and behavioral economics and things like defaults than just simply sort of the Econ 101 rational optimizing model would suggest. And on that, I would actually point out one danger. Taxes are very important, and I'll come to that in a moment. But one danger in looking to the tax code as the end-all, be-all for healthcare reform is that it perpetuates, I think, the myth that financial incentives are all that matters in driving behavior, both on the provider side and the consumer side. Financial incentives do matter, especially on the provider side. But if we want to be talking about driving behavior for especially beneficiaries, I would be much more, I'll give you a specific example, rather than worrying about a tax incentive being 10% or 15% or 20%, I would be much more inclined to look to what the default was for how people were funneled into different plans, rather than whether we were tweaking the match rate or the incentive rate by 5 or 10 percentage points, which is the traditional way of examining what drives behavior. Another way of putting this is I think we need a little less Econ 101, the simplistic version of the optimizing model in public policy, and a little bit more, I don't know whether it's psychology 101 or behavioral economics 101, but in terms of actually studying what drives human behavior, I think we are increasingly learning that things like salience and simplicity and ease and defaults can matter a lot more, at least on the beneficiary side, than financial incentives. I can be happy to take questions about other aspects of pathways to capturing these opportunities. But let me just close by saying very briefly what CBO is doing. We have been significantly expanding our healthcare staff. Last year at about this time, we had 30 full-time equivalents working on healthcare. We now have 47. We also have our first Robert Wood Johnson fellow who is sitting in the audience. We are putting together two significant volumes that will be out at towards the end of this year or perhaps very early next year, in which we are going through all of the things that are under discussion in the policy arena, care coordination, disease management, health information technology, and so forth, so on and so forth. And we will provide CBO's view on what the literature says and in some cases what the quantitative budgetary impact will be, so that no one will be surprised by our views on these major topics as you and others try to put together broad-reaching proposals. I'd also note, and appropriately given the focus on taxes, that we are spending a lot of time in collaboration with the Joint Committee on Taxation. Many proposals involve both tax and spending sides, and the coordination between the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is responsible for estimating the effects of changes on the revenue side, and CBO, which is responsible for combining those estimates with estimates on the spending side, is critically important to make sure that the underlying behavioral assumptions and are basically internally consistent between the two agencies. So there is now a lot more collaboration going on between the two agencies. Let me just close by saying, in looking forward, and I'm doing this mostly as a manager, trying to figure out where our staff should be aligned to meet the potential needs of the Congress in 2009. It strikes me that there are at least four major issues on the economic policy front, and obviously there are other questions that the Congress and the policy world may be addressing in 2009. And frankly, I don't know how they will be sequenced. If the economy is still weak, and I'm not saying that it will be, but if it is, there will likely still be significant discussion about macroeconomic stimulus and housing options and what have you. And frankly, the urgency of that, or at least the perceived urgency of that, may well drive out anything else on the economic policy front. As many people in the, or probably all people in the room know, there's also something that has to happen on the tax front, or something that will likely happen on the tax front, at the very least with regard to the estate tax, if not with regard to all of the expiring provisions of the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation. There's substantial and bipartisan interest in climate change legislation. And then there is the topic that is the subject of today's forum, healthcare, both on coverage and cost. I'm not licensed to practice politics, but it strikes me that there's no way that the political system in 2009 could handle all four of those topics. So some combination of congressional leadership and a new administration will have to figure out how they and perhaps other topics are sequenced. And it's not at all clear to me how that will turn out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, both Jason and Peter. And Peter, I want to toss the first question to you. You have described, perhaps quite appropriately, a much bigger job for the Congressional Budget Office than certainly even the CBO played in the early 1990s, and we know that the way the CBO came out and scored the Clinton plan, dealt that plan a perhaps not the fatal blow, but one of the many fatal blows was dealt to that plan by CBO. But what you're describing is a much even bigger job, because you just laid out a plan where CBO is going to be having to think about behavioral effects of tax incentives or other measures, and of course any time there is a health reform package there will be many other measures. And you also, or I should say not necessarily you, but others have pointed out that it's probably time for CBO to start incorporating some health effects into its analyses of these proposals, which it has never done. So how is CBO going to do all of this? Are you going to panel a bunch of shrinks to start giving you some advice on what the feedback effects might be? How realistically, you've listed some measures about how you're going to approach this in terms of expanding the staff, but realistically, how are you going to incorporate all this analysis into a reasonable scoring set of opinions coming out of CBO?
Well, one step obviously is to somewhat expand our staff because, frankly, I think we fight very well for our weight, but there's so much that needs to be done that I think simply adding to the already quite exceptional staff was necessary. At the same time, I still need to make sure that people can sleep, so there are limits to what CBO can do. I would say in terms of health outcomes, the sort of health effects, that is one area where, at least with regard to the cost estimates, which are intended to serve a different purpose, it's not likely that in the very near term you're going to have a lot of information coming out of CBO about what the impact on health outcomes would be, in part because the research often is not there, and in part because the cost estimation process is designed for a specific purpose, and our papers and studies are a different matter, but the cost estimates themselves. Now, with regard to behavioral effects, I just think it's unavoidable. I mean, if you have anything from Part D to plans that are based, that move away from the employer-sponsored insurance system, or even that tinker with that, thinking about, for example, the most obvious category is default, thinking about what the default is for people is absolutely essential to a reasonable cost estimate. So it's not...
Spin that out a bit more. What do you really mean?
So, for example, in Part D, if under the low-income subsidy people were defaulted into the lowest-cost plan, that would have spending implications. If in the Wyden and Bennett plan there were no default in terms of what happens to people who don't decide, this is a key thing, makes all the difference in the world. We know in study after study after study, whether it's about individual accounts or about the fact that most people don't change their health plans even during the open season periods, that inertia is an incredibly powerful force in human behavior, more powerful, I would say, in most cases, than direct financial incentives. And ignoring that is simply not an option. If we're ignoring it, we're saying it doesn't matter, and I think the evidence is now overwhelming that it matters a lot. And that's just one example, but I guess I'd say this is not simply a choice. I think it's a necessity that we do more of this. I'd also point out it is true we are trying to, I mean, these two volumes that we're putting together are a massive internal effort. And that comes out of, I would say, and I'll be, people in the room may not be surprised by this, I'll be blunt. That comes out of a bit of a frustration that in my former world and frankly in rooms like this, there have simply not been enough specific options put forward for policymakers. It may turn out that policymakers don't want to deal with cost growth. I don't know. But right now they don't have, at least from system-wide effect, they don't have a list of 20 options that credibly would help. There may be two or three or four. There's not a long enough list. Another way of putting the same point is I have not seen, and if anyone in the room has one, please come forward and share it with me. I have not seen a single credible plan that would restore long-term balance to Medicare and Medicaid. And frankly, that's an analytical failing on all of our parts. So CBO is stepping up in part out of frustration, at least on my part, that we haven't been providing policymakers with enough options from which they can choose. And if there were more, then we could perhaps get by with doing less.
Well, here's one. Put all Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life on buses and take them to the Mayo Clinic. Let me ask Gene Sterley of Urban Institute, who, as I said earlier, also has an article in this issue about health and budget reform as hand maidens, to offer us a comment, Gene, particularly on your observation that we not only are we going to run the risk of not dealing with these questions that Jason and Peter have laid out, but also that we will probably run this risk of focusing on benefits at the risk of shifting the costs freely to other parties to pay for them.
Thank you, Susan. I'll try not to take too much time, mainly because I agree with 98% of what the panelists have said. In our article, we sort of proceed from a notion that's a little different than what I hear from a lot of health conferences. I go to a lot of health conferences where people say, well, you know, we know what to do in areas like Social Security, but in places like healthcare, we don't know what to do. And let me use a little metaphor. Let's suppose that we're parents and we're raising children, and the children are evolving all the time, and their needs are constantly changing. We're debating whether we want to educate them, whether they need more playtime, how much TV they should watch. All these are legitimate debates, and they're going to constantly evolve and change. But let's suppose the kids are playing in the street while we're doing these debates. And we're saying, you know, well, we don't know what to do, so we just have to keep this current system in place. Well, I would say, well, we do know what to do. We know to bring them out of the street while we continue the debate. And I think that's sort of what we're suggesting in our article on budget reform and health reform being handmaidens, is that one has to set up processes, and I think that's partly what Peter's about in part in this attempt to list, come up with 20 options. We have to come up with processes that allow these decisions to be made within the normal budget constraints that we all face. Because, in fact, health reform does face a budget constraint, only it's indirect, and it's paid for indirectly by everything else we don't do. So I've done a lot of studies on what's happening to the children's budget, what's happening to the budget for community development. All these other budgets are going into a tailspin, and it's partly, for reasons outlined by our speakers, because we don't have in place processes that say there are limits on what we're going to do in health care, unless Congress votes to increase and spend more there rather than someplace else, or unless individuals as workers, which Jason raised a lot, unless individuals as workers decide, I want to spend more there and less on getting wage increases. So just to summarize, to give you one example of how that plays through and what these two gentlemen have talked about, is if you follow through closely Jason's notion on converting the health exclusion to a credit is a budget-constrained option. And you then, over time, vote for how much that credit increases. And so if you're voting for that over time, you all of a sudden have budget reform combined with health reform. Now, that's an example in the area of employee-provided health insurance and the exclusion. And I think what Peter's going to have to come up with is options like that, and we present some in our paper, in areas like Medicare. Let's have a Medicare system that's constrained within a budget, and if we want to do more, we have to vote somehow or another to vote for those increases. Those aren't easy, but I think we do know what to do. We know not to let the kid play in the street.
Thank you, Gene. Let me open this up to questions and discussion among members of the audience here. And once again, please identify yourself by name and affiliation.
Sharon Canner with the College of Health Information Management Executives. I want to pick up on something that Peter talked about, pathways and opportunities, and one of those is more information on what works. And you hinted at it, and obviously this gets to health information technology. Give you one example. Several years ago, there were a high number of deaths among people taking Vioxx, and Kaiser was tracking this within its system, and it soon figured out there were heart ailments and deaths associated with this, but it was the tracking, the health information, that is technology that is a very, very important tool. And that tracks with quality, and quality eventually saves, you improve quality of care, you save money in the long term. And what I would submit to you is that CBO, which is in a position of scoring the various health information technology pieces of legislation, and in the past there has been a lack of saying that HIT will save money over time. So I would just turn it around and urge you to look very carefully at the potentials. Right now there's the electronic health prescribing bill, provisions of which are now being teamed up with Medicare reimbursement for physicians. So just a plea to look at that real carefully.
Sure. Let me comment about health information technology specifically. Without a change in incentives and without a change in how the information is used, the structure in which just plop in a HIT system into a fragmented system without incentives for better care rather than more care is unlikely to be the panacea that many advocates hope for. Someone likened it to, we're wondering why the toast isn't coming out of the toaster. And some people say you have to plug the toaster in, and other people say you have to put the bread in a little hole, and other people say you have to press the button down. Of course, we have to do all of that. And so health information technology, the biggest return may be that if it were incorporated into a system with better incentives and with a better process of evaluating the information that's coming out of it, it can be a source of information for researchers, and then it can be a mechanism or a platform for pushing information and guidelines and whatever else back down to practitioners. But just by itself, I would not be expecting huge returns. And CBO actually, in the very near future, will be coming out with a quite extensive report specifically on health information technology and specifically examining some of the analyses that are floating around suggesting huge returns. Now, I would also differentiate health information technologies
broadly from e-prescribing specifically, there may well be some modest cost savings from e-prescribing by itself.
Yes. A question here, and then we'll come back to the front.
I'm Karen Linscott with the LeapFrog Group, and what struck me about your presentations was, Jason, you seemed to be really talking a lot about access to care, like tax breaks that would encourage better access to care, where Peter, I think you were talking a lot more about the quality of the care that folks could get access to. Are there opportunities, Jason, to talk about, and you probably have in your article, which I haven't read yet, I'm sorry to say, about tax incentives to improve the quality of care. So, for example, tax breaks for hospitals that put in IT, tax breaks for or reductions if you choose a plan that has the highest quality providers in there. Could you talk about that connection a little bit?
Yeah, I just talk about, which I did very briefly in my comments there too, how some of the tax incentives affect the insurance that people buy. And I think it's through both this traditional economic 101 way of changing the price of insurance. And it's also, as Peter said, and I discussed in the article, through behavioral mechanisms like just letting people know how much their insurance actually costs and how much they're paying for it through their employer and through themselves so they can make more informed choices. I think there's probably a lot more that one could do beyond those steps of creating a better set of incentives for people to purchase the right insurance policies. I think you'd have to ask whether you want those to be tax spent or spending programs at that point. It might be that those other things would be better constructed as directly subsidizing the activities that you want to happen. But it's not something I discuss.
And a question here.
Gary Christofferson, former Fed, current citizen. First, I'm going to reinforce, Peter, your point about HIT. My experience as CIO with Veterans Health is absolutely correct. It's the healthcare reform, not the IT. The IT is a great enabler, but only an enabler there. Let me go back to the point, I think, for both of you, which is, and Peter, you've emphasized it, we've talked about it before, the behavioral aspect. So little is understood by all the different parts of the healthcare system about how behavior comes into play and how we affect it, whether it's in tax policy, whether they're looking at providers, looking at people, what they do in their families, all those different groups. So my question, again, kind of goes back to more detail, which is how do we do what we know least, whether it's doctors trying to deal with people trying to change lifestyle or providers responding to financial incentives or, and you can take any other part of the population, how you use your tax credits, those kinds of things. How do we actually go the next step of building in the behavioral aspect and really understanding how it affects policies and programs?
I'll take a stab at that, and unfortunately it's not a very satisfying stab. In many areas, we simply don't know enough yet to give specific suggestions or guidance or options or what have you. And I guess my point is that needs to change. So we have stunning success in retirement saving with regard to opt-out 401ks. People in this room and the health field in general, I think, need to be searching much more actively for similar things that work. And I mean, there are, I think there are now a compelling sort of rising set of suggestions that it may well work. I think most people want to lead healthy lives, and even small impediments to doing that lead to very large outcome differences. Similar, just the same logic as the retirement saving thing, that even a small impediment having to read through the binder and then sign up for the 401k leads to very large outcome differences. I think there is evidence with regard to both eating behavior, with regard to exercise, with regard to all of the things that influence health outcomes, that kind of thing matters. So the study saying that you should go get a vaccine next Tuesday, very low implementation success. You should get a vaccine next Tuesday at this place, yep, the rate significantly. You should get a vaccine next Tuesday at this place at 4 p.m. and perhaps even the appointment has already been made for you, which you can change if you want to. That flips the default in people's mind, and at that point, having the map and the specific time in their head, they're supposed to show up at 4 p.m. next Tuesday, and the vaccination rates go way up. We're too early to be able to kind of, give policy suggestions or what have you. My point is just we have been neglecting this aspect of human behavior to our peril, because I think this is far more powerful than the things we traditionally study.
Right. If I could add one, I think that also matters for insurance. So you look, if you look purely at financial incentives, you wouldn't understand why the take-up rate for employer-sponsored insurance, where you often have to pay a bunch yourself, is so much higher than the take-up rate for Medicaid. If you look at the behavioral, the stigma, the length of the forms, and even just the automatic decision process, when you go to work for an employer, you're locked in a room until you fill out the form one way or the other. No one does that same thing for Medicaid. You don't see that. And the reason I think that's important is if you want to talk about shifting to the individual market, you lose that automatic decision framework that you have with employer-sponsored insurance. So you lose any single day where you're locked in the room and have to fill out the form, the personnel person, you know, will keep harassing you. And so the traditional concern with the individual market, where if you had chronic health conditions or you're poor, you couldn't get health insurance, I think this behavioral consideration that if you're in the individual market, you don't have anyone to sit down and make you fill out the form on a given day, even to say you don't want insurance, even to opt out of it, I think that could have a bigger effect on whether you get insurance or not through the individual market. So I think we need to think about this in the case of getting health insurance as well as what you get with your health insurance, which Peter was just describing.
What both of you are talking about is a level of prescriptiveness that is not commonly found in much federal legislation. It may be followed up on by regulations that would come out of HHS or others, but really, you're talking about legislation that gets into a level of detail and prescriptiveness of what human behavior ought to be that may be tough for the public to take.
I'm not sure that that's right, and I'm not sure, I should clarify, I'm not sure that this is all policy stuff, but, you know, the fact of the matter is someone, non-policymaker, but, you know, someone running the cafeteria at your place of employment is deciding where the fruit is placed, either at the beginning of the line or at the end of the line. That shouldn't be a federal policymaker, but someone is making that decision. And the evidence strongly suggests that if the fruit's placed at the front of the line, fruit consumption is much higher than if it's at the end of the line. The point is, across a whole sphere of our endeavors, we have not paid enough attention to simple things like that that have very large and significant effects. Now, some things may be influenced by federal policy. I'm coming back to Part D. If we defaulted people into a particular kind of plan, that would have much different effects than, or even if we defaulted the people eligible for the low-income subsidy into particular plans, that would have much different effects than if we defaulted them into other plans or if there was no default at all. And so again, I would say in many cases, it's not like there are new decisions that have to be made. Making no decision is a decision itself.
Jason, you want to add to that?
And this is true in the 401k literature. I think there's an appeal to, and Sunstein and Thaler called it libertarian paternalism, policies that set a default and then let people opt out of it. So if you had automatic enrollment in health insurance, I think this needs to be studied more. I'm not sure exactly what I think about it. You wouldn't be saying everyone has to get insurance. You'd be saying everyone inattentive has to get insurance. And if you really don't want insurance, you can sign the form and get out of it. So I think there's a certain appeal to both sides and some of these types of letting people make decisions but shape how those decisions are made.
Well, the phrase libertarian paternalism is a perfect note to end on because it's sufficiently ambiguous and touching on all different points in a political year. So congratulations on bringing us to a topic we can really understand as we come to grips with politics and health reform, which we'll do in our next session. Thanks to both of you for a terrific All right, we're delighted to have with us now Doug Holtz-Eakin, who has indeed arrived from the McCain campaign. Also with us is Gene Lambrew from the Clinton campaign and formal advisor to that campaign, and David Blumenthal, sorry, I was dropping the T in your name there, David, from the Obama campaign. I'd like to start all of you with talking about some of the public opinion perspectives that Celinda and Bill offered at the outset. Doug, you weren't here, so I'll just briefly restate one of the conclusions, and I think it's a happy one for your side, which is that one of the striking facts is that most voters are insured, and most of the uninsured don't vote. And when you ask the voters what they really care about, the issue is cost.
My work is
done. Okay, you can go home, right? But I want to start by asking representatives from the Democratic campaigns here about that issue, because if that's the case, as I posed the question earlier to Celinda, should Democratic candidates just stop yapping about the uninsured, because the insured voters really don't care that much about them relative to the cost issue, and they have the additional set of concerns that if a lot of uninsured are brought into the healthcare system, that a lot of resources are going to be expended on them, and they're worried that that might be at their cost. So, Jean, let me start with you.
I mean, I will start by saying I think that there's been a lot of attention paid across the spectrum to the coverage policies and even the quality policies that the candidates have talked about. But I'll let David speak for Senator Obama. Senator Clinton began with a speech purely on the cost issue. Clearly, it's an issue that's critical. There are lots of good policies out there. And I think that the duty of people like us is to explain which plan will actually get at this cost crisis. I mean, I think that what we've seen, and we heard about this a little bit in the last panel, is the McCain plan really relies almost exclusively on this idea of the tax policy, trying to move people to the market, the individual market, and having insurers, as you say in Texas, insurers, competing, you know, on a head-to-head basis to try to lower costs in a competitive marketplace. I think what you see in the Clinton plan and the Obama plan is tax policy plus other policies to try to contain costs, including things like the common denominator policies of chronic disease management and prevention, some of the HIT issues that we discussed, but put in place in a system that is comprehensive, that does not leave people out. When you have basically one in three Americans having some gap in coverage over the course of 2 years, it's hard to figure out how you get at the cost system. So I would argue that the debate is about cost. I think the question is which plans will do the best job at restraining costs that Dr. Orzech talked about in the last panel.
David?
Well, I agree mostly with Jean. The way we're going to get to affordability and value is by a comprehensive solution that also addresses the access problem. I don't think we're going to develop a political coalition and a viable approach to reforming the healthcare system that doesn't pay equal attention to both sides of that equation. And one of the encouraging things to me about the debate at the current time is, in fact, that both sides of the aisle are taking the affordability issue seriously and the value issue seriously. What I am not sure I understand yet is exactly how the McCain campaign or the McCain plan would advance cost control other than through the creation of a much larger individual insurance market with all the attendant administrative costs that accompany that.
Well, let's give Doug a chance to respond to that.
Well, certainly, you know, the focus, I think, on tax policy per se and the individual markets badly overrated. You know, the Senator's view is that we have a tax subsidy that supports private insurance, but at the moment it's distributed terribly unequally. And rather than have a tax subsidy that's exclusively to those who get their insurance through their employer and it's greater in value for the high income, he proposes to spread that tax subsidy universally. It's a refundable $5,000 credit. It's the same tax subsidy for insurance regardless of the source of your insurance. It's the same tax subsidy for insurance regardless of your income. And that is a component of his health care reform. But like the others have mentioned, I think one of the encouraging aspects of the debate that we've seen so far is a recognition that the fundamental challenge is to control the growing cost of health care in the United States, and it's the cost of care itself is the central issue, and the fact that it doesn't seem to come with commensurate increases in the quality of outcomes. And what the senator has talked about for the past 16 months is changing the practice of medicine in America. It's a very comprehensive reform, which moves us away from this kind of fragmented fee-for-service medicine that is so common in America, that rewards prevention, that has better care of chronic diseases, which are 70% of our health care costs, and which ultimately has to be the center of attention in any reform, because insurance is simply a financial product that shifts around the nation's health care bill. And the problem is that the nation's health care bill was too large, it's growing too fast, and isn't matched by quality. And so while it is important to have nice competitive insurance markets that don't add extra cost on top of the cost of care, the fundamental focus has to be on care, practice of medicine in America, and undertaking reforms that bring those kinds of practices closer to alignment with high quality care.
I want to come back to Peter Orszag's criticism implicitly of all of the campaign proposals, as well as more broadly of proposals outside of those of the campaign, that none of these plans have meaningful plans inherent in them to restore the fiscal stability of Medicare and Medicaid. That notwithstanding whatever cost control measures you all have put into your plans, some of which frankly may not control costs very much at all. As you know, there's a lot of debate over whether prevention indeed doesn't cost more money often than it saves, specific preventative measures. But how do you respond to that, that you really are not talking about what is really ultimately the big enchilada, which is, are we going to be able to make these programs sustainable over time? Jean?
Well, I think I'll start with what he said, which I think is what these plans address that was not mentioned. You can't necessarily solve the Medicare and Medicaid cost crisis without solving the health system crisis. These are interrelated. The excess growth is related to our health system costs, and we really do need to focus on that. We can't focus on that by just focusing on these two programs. We have to do systemic reform. I'd argue that Senator Clinton and, to a degree, Senator Obama really have put on the table plans that get everybody in. As Henry Arendt said, covering all Americans is a prerequisite for getting our costs system under control, trying to figure out not just, you know, some of the ideas mentioned, but ideas like getting information out there. There's been a fairly wide bipartisan consensus that we need to get comparative effectiveness research produced out there in place and kind of cycled in the best practices into our systems. Dr. Orszag said we don't really know yet what works, but we need to kind of make the kind of federal investment that Senator Clinton's plan would do with her best practice institutes to figure out what that is, but then have the system that can, as he used the toaster analogy, put it all together. We can't put it all together unless we have a comprehensive system. These plans move far towards a comprehensive system, and I would argue that we have to do that before we can even tackle Medicare and Medicaid cost crisis.
But I would guess, based on comments Gene made earlier, everybody would probably acknowledge that all of those measures are necessary to restoring fiscal stability, Medicare, Medicaid, let alone the overall health system, but possibly not sufficient, that there really needs to be some kind of global budgeting, in effect, done on those programs.
I would disagree, because a little bit of a criticism of the proposal that Dr. Sterley has put out there. You know, it's easy to save federal money. We know how to do it. We can just cap our tax credits at a rate of inflation below health care cost growth. We can put a budget on Medicare and Medicaid. Sure, we can do that tomorrow, and that would save costs. But it would save federal costs. It wouldn't necessarily save system costs. And we've seen in the past, it's kind of like a balloon. If you don't get at those cost drivers in the system, you squeeze down the federal part, somebody else's part goes up, and you've done nothing to kind of stem that long-term cost trend. And that's what worries me about proposals that put in artificial constraints without necessarily putting in the systemic differences.
David, how do you see it?
I agree with Gene. As you can see, there's a pattern.
Which
here.
Gene?
This Gene.
Gene Lambert.
Gene is closer to my life. First of all, Medicare is part of our healthcare system. Its problems can't be addressed separately, except through artificial cost constraints that disadvantage the elderly, which is neither defensible morally nor politically practical. The question in trying to control healthcare costs and preserve the value is recalling the percentage of healthcare that Peter Orszag postulated was wasted, whether it's 5% or 30%. The question is, which 5% or 30%
you don't want to deliver tomorrow. So in my role as a primary care physician, I could just decide that on every third patient, I'm just not going to order any tests or provide any treatment. Or I could decide which of those tests and treatments, in my view, are unnecessary. To do that fairly and wisely, to accomplish the goals that we all want, I need a combination of supports that include health information technology, comparative effectiveness research, compensation that rewards me and recognizes the improvements in quality that I attain, and also information transparency that rewards the system of care in which I practice. Now, all those things have to come together simultaneously. And a budget cap is not going to accomplish those things by itself. It may accomplish short-term cost constraints, but it's not going to improve our healthcare system.
Isn't the argument that it will force the system to think about how to provide care that is actually of value and that is generally agreed to be of value as opposed to the vast amount that is not of value?
Well, payment reform is part of all the plans that are before you. And the payment reform short of absolute caps, and I think that's the starting point for reworking our payment system, creating rational incentives. But we haven't found a way that is politically sustainable or capable of being organized at the current time that puts regional or national caps on spending.
Gene, do you want to respond to any of this? Gene Sterling. And Doug, I'm going to come back to you.
Take too much time from the panel. I would like reframe my comments just a little bit. I'm not arguing you should spend more on healthcare. You should actually do things on a more universal basis if you can. I'm saying while we are making those decisions, we still have to operate within budget constraints. So that, for instance, I know that we don't have quality education for everyone, but that education budget operates within a budget constraint. And I know that we don't have quality housing for everybody, but the HUD budget is within a budget constraint. We don't say we can't fix the HUD budget or the education budget, or we can't until we solve this issue of providing universal. And even if we go to something like more universal care, no matter how we get there, we know that under the current system, we're still going to spend enormous amounts of money on ourselves when we're near to death, especially in old age, relative to when we're young, because that's what the current system does. Maybe it shouldn't do it, but nobody even going to a universal system is going to rejigger that quickly and immediately to provide a more efficient and fair system. So I basically just want Congress to have to vote for when it's going to increase its Medicare and Medicaid budgets beyond some reasonable amount and choose that over spending money on our children and other people. And it's just a final comment on whether the Medicare and Medicaid can be dealt with, cannot be dealt with unless we have something like Medicare for All. I think the systems basically follow each other. That is, when Medicare allows prices to go up or allows services to be provided or allows you to have four doctors in the operating room instead of three or whatever else is happening to increase costs, the private sector sort of copies it. They make copies say, well, we'll do 80% of that or we'll do 120% of that. And similarly, when the employer-based system starts keeping costs under control, the Medicare people look at it and say, hey, you know, they've been able to keep prices down here. And they do make cross comparisons. And the notion that they're going to have to get an equally costed price system across them is not correct. And the failure to keep Medicare and Medicaid costs under control, and the employer exclusion, by the way, under control, is actually adding to the number of uninsured people. So it's got this reverberating effect that at the margin, the increased cost is impacting back on the private sector, raising costs in the private sector, and actually increasing the number of uninsured there rather than decreasing it. So it seems to me you've got to say, yes, everything's got to operate within the budget. And then within that budget, let's make these tough decisions.
Doug, as Bill McIntyre noted earlier, Senator McCain felt strongly enough about not getting Medicare into an even deeper hole that he voted against the Medicare reform with the Part D drug benefit. But we're not hearing a lot from the senator at the moment, other than expressing periodically concerns about the long-term rate of growth of Medicare. We're not hearing a lot in terms of specific proposals to address that issue, again, as Peter Orszag said.
Well, I'm not sure I entirely agree. I think the observations that Gene made about the fact that it's easy to save federal costs are the right ones. I mean, if you simply shift costs from the federal budget to private sector, you haven't accomplished anything from a social point of view, and you want to avoid taking that as your paramount objective. There are things that make sense in terms of Medicare reforms for exactly the reason that often Medicare practice patterns drive private practice patterns. And what the senator has said is, take a look at Medicare. Part A, make sure the hospitals get their money. Part B, make sure the docs get their money in a pretty ridiculous fashion, by the way. Part C, make sure the insurance companies get their money. Part D, make sure the drug companies get their money. Where's the patient? Where's the beneficiary? Where's the senior citizen that's supposed to get a coordinated set of high-quality health services? And that's what's wrong with American medicine. I mean, if you look at Medicare, you see the problem. So his proposals are to reform Medicare, specifically Medicare, because that is part of changing America away from this fragmented fee-for-service approach to medical care. And instead, pay for prevention. There is evidence that this is very successful. If you look at the Safeway example, it's just stunning. You take a company that has a $1 billion healthcare bill, 400,000 employees, they start paying for the prevention, dollar one. They focus on wellness extensively in-house. And instead of having, this cost over 3 years go up by $350 million, they're saving money. It's going down. Nowhere else in America is that going on. So if you do change the way we do business and you change what goes on in Medicare as part of that reform, you can have a dramatic impact on the nation's health care bill, and the senator's proposed that. Given that bill, he also is very clear and consistent in the fact that we don't need to have the most affluent of Americans getting a 75% subsidy on average in a drug bill. They can pay their premium. It's nice to have them insurance pool. That's good. But why are we giving a subsidy now to people who are very well off? So he's proposed to reduce that subsidy. I mean, these are very straightforward, common sense things. He voted against the drug bill because he felt it should be targeted on low-income individuals. He can still retarget the bill in that way. And so those are the kinds of things he talks specifically about Medicare reforms and are part of changing healthcare in America.
Doug, before you came, Jason Furman presented and mentioned in particular two conclusions from his article. One is that in the context of healthcare reform, you don't want to do things that have certain costs and uncertain benefits. And particularly, you need to reduce the uncertainty effects of any tax measures by mechanisms outside the tax system. And specifically, what he was talking about there was it's one thing to deal with the employer exclusion, recycle that in the form of tax credits, but unless you create very clear mechanisms for pooling of individuals to buy insurance, you might leave them high and dry again in a dysfunctional individual insurance market. Now, the comeback from the McCain campaign has been, well, we're going to let people buy insurance across state lines. We're going to essentially allow association health plans and pooling from that regard. But to many critics, it doesn't sound as if there really are firm pooling mechanisms created, and particularly pooling mechanisms that could be accessed by people with pre-existing health conditions.
So I think Jason's right in that. The appropriate thing to do is to have the tax credit be universally available and make sure everyone has the access to the same subsidy from the tax code for their insurance. It's important to remember that the primary source of insurance remains employer-sponsored insurance. The greatest threat to employer-sponsored insurance is, in fact, the rising cost of health care that's causing employers to drop coverage, restrict coverage, causing individuals to not take up coverage. So, again, top focus has to be on health care costs. Given that you have the employer-sponsored insurance market as the primary vehicle, there's nothing about the Senate's proposal that is intended to make people have to get out of their employer-sponsored insurance. They'll still get access to the credit if they get their insurance through their employer. There are some people who have stated a desire to have insurance that's portable, and that moves with them. There's a tremendous value to that for people who
you know, are going from job to job. That's a big source of uninsurance for people who are going from job to home. Everybody who has ever had the discussion about, who's going to handle the daycare so you can make the full-time commitment at work so you get health insurance knows that this is mangling people's personal lives. So we wanted to have an option that allowed people to have access to other insurance to get the tax subsidy. I don't think we can get a pooling mechanism that's worse than the current individual market, so that's not my primary concern. The Senator's approach is to try to improve these non-employer insurance markets by providing broader pools, nationwide pools, building on the existing HIPAA protections for people who have pre-existing conditions by going after a best practice model for basically backstop plans for people who are denied coverage and can't have access to private insurance. And so, that's a bridge for those people who want to have a portable insurance policy. We don't yet have a robust individual market. You should have that. Once you've got your individual policy, if that's your desire, most states now, you get renewed. You'll have in place an insurance mechanism that where the insurers now finally have the right incentives, which is, gee, I've got this person. I've got them for a long time. Why don't I pay $1 for preventive services? Get a value design that makes sense over the long term and deal with their chronic conditions better. So, there are virtues once you get there to that kind of an insurance market, but obviously there's a lot of work in improving it because the current individual market is not a good place to be.
David or Gene, you want to comment?
Well, you can achieve stable, affordable health insurance system that's equitable and much more efficient without totally dismantling the employer-sponsored insurance system. It's interesting that as this political year is evolving, that the Republicans and Democrats are exchanging traditional hats when it comes to health system reform. The Democrats traditionally seen as the radical reformers, the ones who want to throw out the current system and impose some ideal and untested, unproven vision of a better system. And the Republicans saying, no, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Now we've got a complete reversal here. The Democrats arguing that we should build on what we have, let people keep what they have, not threaten people, the 160 million Americans who depend on employer-sponsored insurance, with the possibility that, given the option, many of their employers will drop insurance because of the option that their employees will now have to get tax credits. The experience of Quebec that Jason Furman refers to in his article. And instead we have and the Democrats saying, no, we're going to preserve the best of what we have and fill in around the margins to improve performance.
But Bill McIntyre says 36% of voters want radical change. That could be a decisive margin of voters.
Well, I think what they say they believe radical change is and what they will vote on may be two very different things. All our experience with the politics of healthcare reform suggests that, as Bill McIntyre very approvingly said about Senator Clinton, preserving everyone's option to stay exactly where they are without prejudice is going to be the critical underpinning of building a coalition for health care reform.
Gene?
I would just add, we just look at the numbers. I mean, only 5% of Americans, non-elderly Americans, today get coverage in this non-group market. I mean, it would be a dramatic change for most people. I would say you could imagine building on this with a degree of regulation, but the problem is that the idea of insurance shopping across state lines means that we're going to see kind of like the Cayman Islands of insurance, right? State insurers will go to the state that's most profitable for them. That allows them to most effectively avoid high-cost people and attract low-cost people, which I think is exacerbated by having a flat tax credit. I mean, it'll be easy for a healthy person to find a policy that's going to underwrite them that costs $5,000 per family, and I think that's going to exacerbate our average selection system. And the idea of a high-risk pool is either going to be inadequate because it's not adequately funded, like we have today in most states where we have waiting lists and high deductibles and inadequate coverage, more expensive. I mean, the statistics are simple. 10% of Americans account for 70% of costs. So if these high-risk pools are truly effective, they'll be expensive. And so I'm just a little bit anxious that whereas there could be some ideas on the table that would make the individual market work better, the ones on the table would not necessarily achieve that.
We do want to open this up to all of you, but once again, for questions and discussion. So if you have a question again, please signal for one of the microphones and identify yourself by name and affiliation. Let's begin over here in the front.
Thank you. Stacey Probst with Research America. Peter Orzog expressed a frustration that policymakers haven't been provided sufficient numbers of solutions to these particular issues. In your, for your candidates, and as much money as we spend on health care, one of the solutions is research that ultimately improves health and also can improve the health care system. So from your point of view and your candidates' point of view, what is their position on the funding trend for research, private and public, in this nation, which has been going down for the last 5 years or so? Thank you.
I think sort of two thoughts on this. I mean, the first is that I didn't get a chance to hear everything that Peter Orzag said, but the notion that somehow sufficient solutions is the magic political elixir, I think, is misplaced. We have a gazillion, I think is the technical term, solutions for our Social Security financial problems, and we have not addressed them. We need to genuinely have some political leadership to solve this problem, protect Social Security for the future, and that's a political failure. So just make the observation that just having solutions doesn't seem to be the magic bullet. As far as funding, I think one of the senator's deepest concerns about the nature of the funding that comes out of the federal government is that it's been riddled with too much micromanagement instead of focusing on the sound science and letting scientific standards determine what gets research. There's a lot of earmarking that goes on in the research community. He'd like to clean that up, obviously, and that will allow us to have more robust funding in the future than we've had in the past.
Gene. Just very quickly on that, but I think that Senator Clinton has supported having some sort of, independent agency or kind of some relationship with government, but also with outside parties to kind of figure out how we can neutralize the research so it's conducted in a way that gains the trust of the private sector as well as the public sector, but would not only invest in that, but I think we have to look at what's happened in the recent years. Restore scientific integrity. We have a lot of science policy that we need to address, from ensuring that the data that we have available in the federal government is available to researchers, to ensuring that there's not micromanagement, as Doug just said, on some of the projects. So I think there's not just the research funding and potential independent kind of private sector involvement that's needed, but also really trying to adhere to what the scientific community thinks is right in terms of what we should do going forward.
But let me come back to a point that was in Gene Sterling's article, which is that absent change between 2016 and 2020, existing federal revenues will cover only health entitlements, Social Security, debt service, and a smaller defense. How are you going to fund an NIH budget that is even stagnant, let alone a growing one, which is, I think, really what Stacey's question addressed?
I just have to take on this point a little bit. We have had these kinds of projections and forecasts forever. I mean, so long as we've been able to project straight lines, we've been able to say that the sky is going to fall in 5, 7, 10, 15 years. But I disagree that Congress hasn't acted. Congress does act. We act with regularity. Congress has acted with regularity to constrain Medicare and Medicaid costs in the context of larger budget debates. It's part of our budget process. It's part of our PAYGO process. And for better or for worse, we have an ugly process, and I don't think it's pretty. Nobody does. But we have, to date, done a sufficient job in keeping our public program costs in line with private sector cost growth, which is what our yardstick should be. Should it all be down to kind of GDP growth eventually? Absolutely. But we can't just do that by kind of tinkering around with the Medicare or Medicaid growth rates or putting some overall cap on that. We need the systemic reform to do that.
How would Senator Obama juggle these questions?
Well, I think the NIH budget is a rounding error in the in the federal budget, really. And I think the return on investment to that and to the our investment in biomedical research and also in comparative effectiveness research and system-related research is enormous and would be a very good investment of any money that was saved on redeploying troops out of Iraq, just for an example.
All right, let's take another question here, please.
Yes, hi, Stephen Langell with Congress Now. I was wondering, looking at healthcare reform, if you could give me your take on the effectiveness, drawbacks, viability of the Wyden-Bennett plan for healthcare coverage.
And Senator Wyden was here earlier, Doug, speaking about that. Doug, let's start with you on that.
The campaign has no official position on the legislation. I'm not going to discuss it.
Ditto. Okay, well, we are not going to let you off the hook here because, as Senator Wyden said, his is the only proposal, taking the three of yours and his, of those four, only one has picked up bipartisan support at the moment. He also went on to say it's not that it's going to be, from his perspective, that or nothing. Obviously, ideas are going to be teed up and there's going to be a lot of discussion. But given that already that kind of a blended approach seems to have some appeal, why are you proposing the things you're proposing? Doug.
Let me just dispute that a little bit. I mean, despite the sad intent of the people on the other side of the table here to come and just attack me today,
It's shocking, isn't it, election year?
But the reality is that there was an enormous amount of commonality in identifying the problems, in addressing the solutions on prevention, chronic disease, changing practice of medicine, paying for quality outcomes, coordinating care, providing incentives as a result for comparative effectiveness and value-driven medicine. I mean, I've been on roughly 700 of these panels in this campaign, and there's a lot going on that is absolutely bipartisan in nature, and the next president will have to do health care reform, period, not an option. The next president will have to get it through Congress in a bipartisan fashion, period, not an option. And I would dispute the notion that somehow Mr. Wyden has an exclusive claim on bipartisan action in this area. That's what's going on right now in this campaign. There are differences, and important differences, across the candidates. There are important commonalities as well, and I'm optimistic that come the next Congress with the new president, McCain, in my view, we'll start to address this issue. It's an imperative that we must.
Well, one of the critical pieces of the Healthy Americans Act is a movement away from employer-provided health insurance, and your two campaigns are sticking with the program of employer-provided health insurance. So let's talk about that.
Sure, although I want to go back and something that Doug said. We need to figure out how we do it, but I think that we all agree that keeping the employer system as a choice is something we'd like to do. I think most economists would argue that you have to keep that tax exclusion somehow in place to do it. And I will say Senator Clinton deserves credit. She is the only Democratic politician I know of who has stood up and said that she will limit that exclusion for high-income people. She will cap it as part of her way to finance a progressive sliding scale tax credit for low-income people. But I think that, at the end of the day, we have to kind of drill down on these policy details because I think there is bipartisan support for lots of different ideas, but it is a different proposal than what I think we see from both Clinton and Obama to say that we're going to spend $220 billion a year in kind of the gross costs that will change the tax incentives that everybody gets in the employer-based system to something new and won't actually cover that many Americans. We don't know yet. I don't have any idea of how many uninsured will gain coverage by this policy, but if the goal is to contain costs and cover Americans, we do have to get into this policy debate about what is the best way to do it. Is getting rid of the tax exclusion like Wyden, like McCain, does that work if we reinvest it back in tax credits? What types of tax credits? Should they be sliding scale? Should they be flat? And where do people get coverage? These are critical questions, and I don't think we can dismiss them.
David.
Well, Senator Obama is proud of his plan and will stand behind it, and looking forward to running on it. At the same time, we all know that we elect presidents, not health plans. He's also someone who has spoken forcefully for new politics, for bipartisan politics, for bringing all interest groups to the table, and I'm sure he'll have an active dialogue with Senator Wyden as the campaign goes on and if he's elected once he takes office. So I don't think that, I think that the pros and cons of all these proposals will need to be aired and considered as the discussion goes forward.
This is getting much too polite, so we'll have to shake it up a bit. Let's take a question here.
Ken Kelly with the Children's Partnership, and I wanted to focus a little bit with regard to our nation's greatest strategic resource, which is our kids. Children with health insurance are more likely to get the timely health care that they need. Conversely, children without health insurance are less likely to get treated or delay treatment, potentially resulting in higher future costs. And right now, approximately 9 million kids are uninsured. I wanted to know what your candidates plan to do to address affordable, comprehensive health care for kids and their general timeline for implementation, considering what happened in 110th Congress regarding SCHIP.
Well, and we might piggyback on that question by suggesting that the first, one of the first things up on the plate for the next president will be SCHIP reauthorization. So, Doug, since Senator McCain has made fairly clear that he is not particularly interested in lots of new government expansions of government-financed health insurance coverage, what will his position be on that?
He, as he said in the last SCHIP debate, is fundamentally interested in making sure that we get the 6 million out of the 8 to 9 million children who are uninsured, the 6 million who are eligible for SCHIP on SCHIP. I mean, that should be the primary objective in any reauthorization of SCHIP, is to cover the original targeted population. And the failure to focus on that is a great misstep in the senator's view. So that would be an important step number one. He also is absolutely of the belief that everyone should have access to some support in buying health insurance, and that giving families $5,000 in the equivalent of cash to buy health insurance is a step in the right direction. That is a better use of the tax subsidy than to you know, reward bells and whistles plan for some rich American. And so, he's going to focus on the existing government programs. He's going to expand where possible the private programs and march toward the objective of making sure that we can get better care at lower cost for every American.
But Senator McCain voted against the financing in as well as the whole reauthorization, and particularly he singled out the cigarette tax hike as a non-starter for him. How does he propose to fund even the enrollment of eligible children?
The last SCHIP episode was classic Washington politics, right? You disguise the cost of the bill with this sort of big cliff at the end of the bill. You have a funding mechanism that either relies on people smoking and says it's funded, or people stop smoking and it's underfunded. You expand the program before you bother to get the kids enrolled. And so he just said, no, enough of this stuff. There are national priorities. His goal is in the federal budget is to make sure that taxpayer dollars are focused on national priorities. There can be no greater priority than our nation's children. That is the heart of his campaign. It is why you care about climate change. It is why you care about changing the education system. It's why you care about keeping Americans safe and fighting the terrorists who want us to harm our way of life every day they wake up. So, you will absolutely have to focus the dollars on those programs, and that's not a problem.
And so the idea for funding SCHIP is?
It doesn't have to have a unique funding mechanism. We pay for it out of taxpayers' dollar. We're already taking 19 cents out of every American's dollar. We can, spend the money on the kids without a problem.
Jean?
I just, the SCHIP debate, I think, has sort of morphed into, and I think it is a classic Washington debate because there's so much misinformation. Congressional Budget Office said 4 to 5 million uninsured children would have gained coverage under this legislation over 80% of whom are already eligible for the program. The dollars were out there to kind of provide the sort of financial incentives for states and families to come in. It costs money to cover kids. The bill costs money. The source of the revenue that they decided to choose to fund it is actually good public health policy as well as good health policy. I mean, good revenue source. If you can simultaneously reduce smoking, reduce your long-run costs, and help kids, it's hard to imagine why that's objectionable. We are, every day that this bill is not reauthorized, there are children out there who are remaining uninsured, so I think it's been truly an ugly part of the Washington process that hopefully with a new president will change. David.
Well, I think Senator Obama has made very clear his commitment to help children. He voted for SCHIP, but he's committed to expanding it under his own presidency. He has gone as far as to mandate coverage for children under his proposed plan, so I don't think there's going to be any equivocation about his commitment to total universal coverage for children at the outset of his administration.
Just a quick procedural question. If your candidates are elected president, how are they thinking about sequencing this debate? Because the clock is ticking on SCHIP reauthorization. That's March. Are they thinking we'll put up a big McGilla plan first and sweep SCHIP into that? Or are we going to take SCHIP first and then use that as a dialogue, an entry point into the dialogue of overall reform? David?
Well, I think it would be premature for me to comment on that.
It
would be a nice problem to have. But I think, these kinds of tactical questions are things that I think are best left to a transition period.
Okay, we punted on that one. Doug, let me try you.
Oh, I can punt on that one, too. As near as I can tell, there are no rules in a campaign except you don't discuss sledge strategy on the trail, so no.
Okay, well, I'll leave it to the rest of you to assault these people as they leave the room today and try to torture them into an answer here. Let's take a question from my esteemed predecessor, John Eichelhart, and then we'll come back here.
Taking a cue from Gene Sterling's call for a budget and the process by which it's allocated, my question is how the candidates might respond to a proposal that would consolidate Medicare funding silos into one, creating a budget basically out of that pie of money, and then really letting providers and suppliers decide how to carve up that pie in a way that would incent them to integrate coverage and a delivery system in a way that's not there today.
I think that's a very intriguing proposal. There's a clear need for integrating the different providers and having a sort of a care system that is much more coordinated and focused on paying for outcomes, having a different kind of payment system. So that's entirely consistent with a lot of the things the center is focused on and thinking about it. And there are perverse incentives in the way we do things now, which is we pay people more for failure than for success. And so I think he'd be open to looking at that. Certainly you'd want to build in the right incentives for value, and that would be the heart of getting it right rather than just consolidating funding streams. I think that's a more important part of the design than just getting the numbers in one place.
Either of you want to comment on that?
I can't speak specifically to what Senator Klein would say about that policy. She does include a series of policies in her plan that would begin to try to again move towards these integrated types of models, medical home types of models, thinking through kind of, again, more of an episodic-based sort of payment system, as well as more coordination. But that's not just in Medicare. It's a little bit more across the board in the health system, because we know that those are ideas that seem to work, and ways to harness them are beginning with Medicare and even Medicaid, because that's a place where we have considerable opportunities to improve health and costs. David.
Ditto.
Okay, now we're getting down to the short here. Question here, please. Right up here in the middle, and then we'll move back over to that side, and then over here.
Hi, I'm Bob Graybois with NFIB. And if IB played a big part in 1994, we'd like very much to play a very different part, a part this time around. Our members tend not to view the status quo as a very appealing option. They're about 18% higher on premiums, rising faster than for the rest of the community, and probably 28 to 30 million of the uninsured are in the small business community. So could I ask each of you just to discuss what can you do to make healthcare reform a good thing for the small business community and bring us into the conversation?
Gene, why don't you start since Senator Clinton specifically has a plan for dealing with small business.
Sure, and I would say the plan that began with reaching out to the small business people, owners, and associations because she recognized the last time that that was a big issue that was not adequately addressed. In her plan, in addition to the policies that we can go through at length to reduce the overall costs of healthcare and the premiums, she would do two other things. Number one is give all small businesses the same choice of health insurance plans that members of Congress have. They would be allowed to come into this new health choices menu pool and avail themselves of the same choice, both of the private plan options that are out there, but also of a public plan option, like a Medicare option, that would be available in that plan. So they would have lower costs, more choice, but she also would explicitly try to give small businesses a tax credit, because if we think about that erosion of employer-based coverage, it really is occurring amongst small businesses. That's where all the action is. And to the extent that small business owners want to continue to do this, she wants to give them the incentive, the ability to do that, dovetail with the kind of subsidies that will be available in this pool for low-income individuals. So I think the idea here is to reduce costs, provide choices, but also make it viable for those small business owners who still want to do this to stay in the game.
Doug.
Well, the senator's tailored his tax proposals to make sure that there's access for everyone to the tax subsidy. That would include small businesses through their employees. There are in some states, Missouri, for example, that just ruled that those employers could even purchase individual policies on behalf of their employees. And there's a lot of going to be a lot more options available if we provide the funding more broadly and reform insurance markets to give people more choices.
And David.
Well, there's a fair amount of agreement has been throughout the Democratic primary about changes in the small group and individual market that I think hold a great deal of promise for small businesses. The Obama approach is specifically to create a national health health insurance exchange whose effects on administrative costs we believe would be dramatic and make care much more affordable. Proposal of a reinsurance proposal to reduce catastrophic expenditures and together with other cost reduction proposals, it's our projections that we would save about $2,500 for small business premiums right off the bat. So I think that making those premiums more affordable through reforming markets and through other health care cost containment activities, including reinsurance, is the direction that the Obama plan would have.
David, let me just quickly ask you a follow-up question on the reinsurance plan, because although that proposal is out there, you're proposing to step in when anybody incurs more than $50,000 of expenditures and have that difference taken over by the federal government, paid by the federal government. The cost estimations of that proposal are just enormous. I think it's $600 billion over 10 years. And on top of that, most people will say that $50,000 is way, way too low a number to set in the current day and age. You can get to $50,000 practically with a broken toe in the current healthcare system, and that unless you're talking realistically about something like $100,000, this proposal alone could essentially bankrupt the nation.
Well, those expenditures are built into our expenditures already. So we're just we're moving expenditures out of the pockets of small businesses and other businesses and onto the federal budget. But our projections are that in aggregate, our new on-budget expenditures for the federal government will be about $65 billion a year, which we believe with the changes in other tax proposals that we've made are affordable. So you know, I think the total package, when you look at it and put it together, is an affordable package.
How could that possibly be a realistic projection, though, if the reinsurance proposal alone would cost as much as the predicted to cost?
Well, it's something of a, I'm dependent a little bit as a family, just a country doctor here, on the economists who I work with.
Oh, very bad move.
But, you know, David Clutton, Jeff Liebman, Stuart Altman, the other economists who have helped me out with these projections assure me that the aggregate net cost is about $65 billion.
Let me come back to Bob and ask you. We heard from Bill McIntyre earlier that 43% of small business owners want radical change. Do you know what they mean by radical change? What do they want? You're frowning.
We do extensive surveying, and we see interesting trends out there. I mean, I think the figure is, and we don't view this as a very great thing, 20% say they would favor single payer simply out of frustration. We see, as we've been traveling the country doing public forums like this quite a bit, we've found a surprising number who have favored individual mandates. A slight majority in some of our polls seem to indicate some support for that, but the organization has taken no position on individual mandates. I can tell you that radical change for them would not include more employer mandates, but we still find a very, very low percentage favoring more employer mandates. And I guess the other big sticking point is considerable fear that change ends up with large payroll taxes, which have the effect of leading to outsourcing or replacement of labor with capital, which are things that our members in the larger community fear.
Radical change, but not at the expense of radical cost, basically, is
right,
the message.
Right. They don't want to be put out of business, and large payroll taxes would have that effect. An awful lot of our members have quite thin margins, not a lot of leeway for financing the whole thing.
Is there a difference between female business owners and male business owners? Shalinda was talking about how the women are tending to assign much more to values like security, et cetera. Do you detect any difference therein?
I don't know that, but we've got the data and certainly can check it if anyone wants to contact us and ask. We do have, at least in our organization, a very high content of women as members. I don't recall tremendous differences in them, but I may be missing the data.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's move on. We have a question here, and then we'll come back to the back.
Thanks. Bob Rohr with BMJ. I want to focus on HIV/AIDS, which is an area where the federal government spends disproportionate amount of the total funding in that area. Only 4% of total funding, of the federal funding, goes to prevention in this area. Contrast that with the international side with PEPFAR, where about 20% of the funding goes for prevention activities. I'd like to hear what the candidates would propose in terms of incentives or changes that might change this and emphasize the whole prevention aspect with, you know, which could be enormously effective in terms of a very expensive disease.
Jane. It clearly is a priority for Senator Clinton. She mentioned it first, I think, in almost most of her speeches because she really does care personally, passionately about this. You know, you start out with community-based prevention. We do need to improve our public health system so that we can actually get into the schools and workplaces and churches and playgrounds and kind of the places where we can begin to promote that kind of community-based prevention that really matters, especially when we talk about the obesity crisis. Second, she really would try to coordinate and consolidate the existing federal spending on prevention and health. I don't want to say the word wellness because Celinda told me not to say that, but prevention policy. Because we do have pockets of spending throughout the federal government in CDC, in HRSA, and the public programs. So trying to coordinate that spending to really focus on high priority prevention is part of her plan. She would, as a condition of doing business with this new health choices menu pool, say to insurers, you come in, you have to cover the range of preventive services because that really is a way to make a difference. We know that small co-pays can distract people from getting the kind of prevention they need. So she really would ensure that there is a aggressive coverage policy in her health choices menu pool. But lastly, I would say that when we talk about kind of trying to address the long-run cost challenge, she notes that if you look at Medicare cost trends, a significant part of the reason why Medicare costs are going up is chronic illness. And unless we can figure out how to reach back to the younger populations, we can't just solve the Medicare cost crisis with prevention at the age of 65. I mean, honestly, the best thing that Medicare could do to solve this cost problems is invest in childhood obesity reduction and trying to get back into the younger ages to produce a healthier adult population. So she would argue that we need to have a systemic approach to prevention that's not just siloed in private insurance companies and the public health world, but across all programs so we really can get at 100% use of proven preventive services. Doug?
I would echo a lot of it. Senator really believes that the heart of this is education, prevention, and his plan has also focused heavily on this, particularly with children where there are obvious moral obligations by parents to better educate their children about healthy lifestyles and wellness over the course of their lives, and also a place for better education, public health messaging. So he would echo that.
David.
Well, it would be hard to find, from a historical perspective, a candidate who's more likely to be sensitive to the problem of HIV/AIDS, given the impact that this disease, disproportionate impact that this disease has on underrepresented minorities in our country. And I am fully confident that Senator Obama would be very, very supportive of AIDS prevention and AIDS treatment programs.
We have time for just about two more questions, so let's take one at the back there, all the way in the rear.
Thank you, Merrill Gutzner with the Center for Science and the Public Interest. It's actually a follow-up question because it is on prevention. I want to just ask the question that Susan sort of asked in the last panel, which was there is a growing consensus, I guess, or emerging conventional wisdom that prevention costs more than it saves, and I would like to hear you address that directly, specifically if you go through prevention. Some do save money, some don't, as with any medical intervention or type of intervention. So what are some specifics that the candidates think ought to be addressed in the short run that could actually save money?
And again, we have to probably rely on some of those dubious economists to estimate the real effects of these things. David, what is the Obama campaign talking about that really has demonstrable cost-saving potential?
Well, I think the key here is comparative effectiveness research. We know something about prevention, and we know vaccinations. Some vaccinations often actually cause actual savings. Others are humane and cost-effective ways of preventing illness. We know that much secondary prevention is within the range of cost-effectiveness that makes sense to invest in. There is a certain arbitrary quality to where you draw lines on any healthcare technology in terms of what return you expect in order to justify it. But what we do need most of all is informed payment policy and the ability to deliver new information and effective information to the point of the decision as physicians and other healthcare professionals make decisions about which care to recommend to an individual patient sitting in front of them. The comparative effectiveness basis for deciding which prevention policies makes sense. We have, you know, we give out statins, lipid-lowering medicines, willy-nilly to all kinds of people on speculation with nowhere near the information we need to decide whether it's an effective preventive, for example, for middle-aged people with no risk factors and high cholesterol. So there's a lot we need to learn to make this more effective.
And I would just add that, you know, what we also need, and I think we see this in Senator Clinton's plan, and we've seen this in other bipartisan proposals, is an arbiter to try to figure out of the things that we know that are effective in prevention, and we actually even have, through the Partnership for Prevention, a group that kind of looks at cost effectiveness as well as clinical effectiveness. If we could target those things that we know work, that we know have some sort of potential cost benefit savings, although I'd argue that that's not necessarily the criteria you always go by, then we could, if we implemented those, really make a difference. So Senator Clinton has established practice institutes that would begin to kind of identify high priority prevention, and if we targeted that, that would potentially have the kind of savings. But again, I'll repeat, like chronic disease management, like anything else, loosely targeted, poorly targeted, broadly applied prevention, like chronic disease management, won't necessarily produce savings. It really has to be done well and smartly in a system that can be responsive to it.
Doug?
Yeah, I think the Senator's view is that the key is to recognize that you need to have this done in a decentralized fashion. You don't need to have people in Washington sitting deciding what prevention is good and bad, cost, more cost, plus. You need to develop a system that has built-in incentives that are appropriate for, first of all, a business model for health insurance technology, where if you're paying for outcomes and coordinated care, there's a reason for people to integrate their systems and trade information. Like, you know, modern information systems are the best way to do that. That will allow you to pick up automatically the practice patterns that are out there, identify those which have good outcomes versus bad outcomes, identify the relative costs of those, find out where those costs can be made higher or lower by preventive efforts instead of acute treatments. And so you want to build the system to actually seek that kind of information, seek the profitable kinds of prevention, not decide it somehow in a big government way that, you know the right answers, and these are the good preventions, these are the bad ones. You have to build the system to seek them out.
Okay, we'll take one last question here. Actually, Gene, is it a question or a comment? Quick comment, and then we'll come back here.
Just a quick comment. I'm going to propose a bipartisan Blumenthal, Lambrow, Holtzbeacon, NFIB proposal that I think takes the best of all worlds. I'll be very quick. You take a credit like the Senator McCain wants to propose per family, so that you go towards universality, deal with the issue of employers, you require that employers have to offer a plan which this credit can be provided, so you take into account this issue of making sure the employers have to stay in the network and they play with the default options that Jason talked about. Because you can't get there entirely on the cost side, you've got to subsidize insurance pools to really make sure that people can buy things. Because you still can't get there on the cost side, you've got to integrate in the types of mandates that the two Democratic candidates are talking about, but inadequately, because you can't mandate that people are going to spend $10,000, you can't collect it. You can put a mandate on in terms of a penalty when people don't buy, in terms of making them lose tax and other benefits if they don't buy insurance, which you can reflect in withholding. And so I think that's sort of a way of trying to combine the best of all the worlds. I think there is a bipartisan compromise in here that takes into account the deep concerns of various interest groups.
I didn't see any of you taking notes. I assume assume you absorbed
all
of it.
Sounds a little bit like something that's going on in my state. But
in Massachusetts. Yeah. Let's take a final question here from Ricardo.
Go ahead. Hi. Yeah, Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar with the LA Times. And I'd like to ask the panelists to comment on the prospects that healthcare reform will be overtaken by events. They say it's such a difficult subject that the first president, the next president would have to do it first, tee it up right away. But it seems like the economy, energy, and Iraq would come first now. What are the odds that maybe we should be refocusing on incremental here?
or even the odds that we'll even get to incremental. David.
Well, I think you've got candidates, at least on the Democratic side, that care deeply about this. And if there's any way to get to it, I'm confident they will get to it. What the voters decide in the next election will be critical to answering your questions. And what they actually decide to vote on will be critical to answering your questions. So the debate, it's going to be important that the debate deal with health care, and I think it will. Having dealt with health care, it will then be important that voters go to the polls and vote on health care. And that will clear the way for, I think, a candidate who cares deeply about this issue to give it the priority it deserves.
Gene.
Yes, Senator Clinton has repeatedly said that health reform is her top domestic priority, but I would make the case that it is economic policy as well as health policy. When we look at the recent trends where health premium cost growth has been quadrupling what the wage growth has been, it's affecting working families, it's affecting their take-home pay, the out-of-pocket spending is increasing as a percent of income, it's affecting families' economic security, it's affecting businesses. We heard it from NFIB. We know that the business crisis, in a way, is because the health costs are overtaking profits from their investments and their ability to kind of compete in the global marketplace. And as Peter Orzag said, it's a fiscal crisis. We cannot ignore health costs because that there's that $700 billion of whatever you call that dead weight in the system that could be turned into economic productivity. So it is a top priority, but it is not just a health policy issue. It is an economic policy issue. And that's why I think it would be a top priority of certainly Senator Clinton, but hopefully any president who comes in.
Doug.
I think it's been clear from the many town halls the Senator has done, from the debate that has occurred in the primary and now looking forward to November, that this is a pressing national issue about which people care deeply. It is an economic issue for competitiveness reasons, for pocketbook reasons. It is a clear situation in which the next president will have to act. And it would be better for the next president to act in a proactive fashion. I don't think health care reform will be a bill. I don't think it'll be something that looks like an up or down vote in either the House or the Senate. What's at stake in the election is the vision toward where we march. And the American people will choose the next president in part based on that vision. But the actual march will be a day-to-day kind of affair. It will require continuous incremental changes to move us toward a system that respects Americans' values in their pocketbooks, in their freedoms to make choices, and delivers a healthcare system that is commensurate to the dollars that we're spending on it, and indeed can do what it's doing now for spending a great deal less. I don't think it'll be overtaken by events for that reason. It's a pressing issue, and action is required.
At the risk of sounding like a reality game show TV host, let me just say that if we were to come back here next December, we would have noticed that at least two of you will have been voted off the island, and only one of you would remain. So I'm going to ask you to project yourselves forward and tell us, if you are the one who's left on the island, if you are the survivor, given what we heard already this morning about the many disparate attitudes that voters seem to hold, and in some cases, as Celinda said, mutually contradictory attitudes. They want stability, but they also want choice. They don't want a government-run system, but they also don't want insurers to particularly make that much money, et cetera, et cetera. Well, give us a sense, if you're the one left on the island, what you think the next president would do to try to forge a public consensus around healthcare reform. Doug, let me start with you.
Well, I think given the nature of the importance of the problem and the fact that there are so many aspects to it, that it is now intertwined in every aspect of American life, that you can't build a consensus about all of healthcare. Instead, it'll be important to pick the most important step to make first. And you know, that in Senator McCain's view is what can we do to control the rising costs and change the practice of medicine? Let's talk about that issue. And then take the next step, which is how can we more broadly make insurance available, provide a fair and equitable support to private insurance through the public sector, and fortify the existing government programs. And so I think because reform has to be incremental, you'll have to have a vision and bring people together on each piece as you go.
I would just argue that one of the things that Senator Clinton has said repeatedly is that she learned from the last episode that you can't walk in with a 1,300-page bill, but you really do have to come in with a vision and an outline, but not flesh out all the details. She is very willing to roll up her sleeves and work across the aisles to try to figure out how we create what she would call a uniquely American solution to this healthcare crisis, and I think it could, because we do know there are these conflicts. Ensure that there is both the security that people want, but the options, the choices that they demand. I'll just say, though, I think that you can't necessarily do this piece by piece, because what we know is that our rising costs affects access, and our access problems affect quality. They're all interrelated, and so trying to do more incremental policies at the same political capital cost, I think in her view, it's not the right answer. The right answer is trying to get at the root causes and try to systemically reform the system.
And last word to you, David, about achieving this consensus or at least something closer to it than what we appear to have now.
Well, I'm still on the island.
Yes, you're still on the island in this version.
That's right. I think that both of my co-panelists have captured the key themes. The presidential leadership, presidential vision, the mandate, hopefully that that person reaps from the election, will set a very important tone and a very important direction for a conversation. But what will follow will be a conversation across all the groups that need to be part of this solution. And it's wildly premature, I think, to predict what shape the conversation will take, what mechanism will be put in place, what process will make sense at that time. But I'm confident that it will be a process, and that the most vital factor in this will be the president's vision and leadership and ability to mobilize and communicate with the American public about the choices and the trade-offs that need to be made, and to create a path where they will feel comfortable moving in that direction, a path where they believe they'll have a choice, where what matters to them will be preserved, and where they will come out better at the end.
Well, as Bill McIntyre told us, politics runs in dog years, not real years. So 1 year, a normal calendar year, is actually 7 dog years in politics. That means that the election is, by my calculation, 4 dog years away. That's a long time. It's an opportunity for plenty to happen and plenty to change. And as Yogi Berra said, predicting is very hard, especially when it involves the future. We can safely predict that one of you three will be left on the island. We can also safely predict, I think, that you will be reading much more about these issues in health affairs as the months go by. And most of these articles are going to be written by some of the various esteemed people we've had on this panel today, as well as others of you in the audience. So let me say thank you to all of the participants in today's sessions for a very, very rousing set of discussions. Thanks also to this panel, and thank you.
Good job.